Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Down in Front. Our movie this week is The Princess Bride.
As you wish.
The 1987 freaking classic from Rob Reiner, starring Cary Elwes and Andre the Giant, and of course,
And written by a guy that is essentially the fifth member of Down in Front.
The fifth Down in Fronter, William Goldman. Now on the table tonight is myself, T. Christie, and my friend.
Hello.
Mr. Brian William Finifter.
Hi.
And of course, Mr. Michael Dorkman Scott.
Hi, everyone.
And as always, here for your pleasure. Women, take heed.
Oh, dear.
Trey the Amazing Stokes.
Hey, ladies.
Now, gentlemen, The Princess Bride was a book that became a movie after years of William Goldman trying to get it to be a movie.
And years of refusing to let it be made by the wrong people into a movie.
Which is a stunning act of clarity in the film industry.
No, it's not. Not from a screenwriter. Yeah. It's just he happened to have the control to prevent it in this rare case.
Very few people have the credit to go, no. Not you.
Goldman always felt that The Princess Bride was his best, most shiningest jewel of a work, and he was just always very careful about ever letting anyone talk about making it into a movie.
Brian Finifter, do you agree that The Princess Bride is William Goldman's best work? Screenwriter, actor, Brian William Finifter?
You know what? I hate this movie. I don't understand how anybody likes this movie. I don't get it. I think it's awful. And
Brian, are you being ironic for the kids at home?
I'm just going to try to add conflict because I'm afraid that this whole thing is going to turn into
this is just going to turn
into this is awesome.
This is awesome.
Everybody loves The Princess Bride. How do you know?
Who doesn't love The Princess Bride?
At what point in your life did The Princess Bride become a thing?
I don't know. Some point in my childhood. It was probably like in the, if you have your cast of characters as classic movies from kids, it was probably in the secondary characters. It wasn't in the League of Indiana Jones for me, but it was there.
Okay, cool.
It was there.
Which means you grew up straight.
What?
Moving on.
I forgot to mention, by the way, the pause point is when the MGM logo fades to black. So get up, queued up there, and we'll move on.
Yeah, while we do whatever we're doing right now.
Michael Dorkman Scott, The Princess Bride, William Goldman, how do you feel?
I like this movie.
Oh, Jesus. You're not going to say it's overrated, are you?
Well,
oh my goodness.
I won't say it's overrated. I understand the popularity in terms of it being like ridiculously quotable. Like, I get that part. because it definitely is. But, the part where it's a classic and everyone's like, oh, I love this movie. And like, it's on, you know, it's their, on their top 10 favorites and stuff. I'm like, it's not there for me. I like this movie. I can't really fault it for anything, but it just doesn't really, I guess, capture my imagination the way other movies do.
I would not have guessed that. I would have thought you'd have been solidly in the camp. Yeah. That's interesting.
Now, Trey the Amazing Stokes, Princess Bride, how do you feel?
I'm solidly in the It's Awesome camp.
Good man.
Good follow.
Unlike this douchebag to my right. I don't know what the hell he's thinking.
My opinion might change. That's happened on these shows.
No, your opinion is different from mine, therefore you're wrong.
Yeah.
The internet.
We completely turned Dorkman around on Wild Wild West, let me tell you.
Oh, yeah. Go listen to that
we
one.
We turned him out, as they say, in prison. But, I love this movie, and it's okay that you don't. I'm actually, of course, you know, being facetious about that.
Well, I don't hate this movie.
I know.
I'm just saying.
Like, we've had...
Dorkman hates this movie.
Dorkman hates The Princess Bride. I don't get that, but, you know...
I guess on the bell curve, if we're grading on a curve here, like comparatively, I suppose I do. Yeah. But...
Well, again, it is the internet, so it's like, if you don't love it, then it must suck. There's no middle. Nice, well played. I think it's a great movie. I saw it when it came out, and it was a big deal, and it was like, oh wow, that was really fun, and it was a good date movie. That's also important. I really like this movie. I would put it, whether, you know, maybe this time Michael wouldn't agree, but I'd put it definitely in the category of the perfect movie list.
Totally, 100%.
Yeah, I can't think of any reason it couldn't belong on that list.
This
easily.
Movie no. might be the category title heading on the Excel spreadsheet of
perfect movie.
Well, actually for me that was Pirates of the Caribbean 1. That's the movie that led me to define the now oft-quoted perfect
and
movie.
And fair enough. I don't particularly love Pirates of the Caribbean, but I can see how it goes on the perfect movie list, you know. So
for
there
real.
You go.
But
now, let's
but
go ahead.
But by the same token, I would actually agree with that for Princess Bride, and it's a good example of what we've talked about before. It's like you don't have to love it to be able to say, "Yeah, that does everything it's trying to do," and I can't see anything else it should have done.
Now, for the first time in Down in Front history, we're going to do something that I haven't even discussed with the crowd, and we've never done before: going around again. My favorite line in The Princess Bride.
Oh my.
Is never start a land war in Asia. Yeah. Brian, what's your favorite line from The Princess Bride?
It would probably be a toss up either between, you know, have fun storming the castle, think it'll work, it'll take a miracle, so long, or give us the gate key. What gate key? Fezzik tears arms off. Oh, that gate key. Yeah. Well, either of those two.
Can you even enter into this category? You said it was quotable.
It is quotable, but that doesn't mean I quote it.
You have standards, I guess.
I mean, it's the only one I can think of is Inigo's thing, and that's almost too easy, so I would feel embarrassed quoting that one.
You killed my father, prepare to
die. Yeah, hello, my name is Inigo Montoya, you killed my father, prepare to die. And more specifically, when that comes back around and he can't complete it because he keeps getting his ass kicked. That is the best part of the movie to me.
Yeah. Trey Stokes, the number one quotable line from Princess Bride for you.
You know, I think I would have to go with, as far as quotable, I would have to say, never entered a land war in Asia is the one that I find the most memorable. But the one that I like to use that isn't quotable, but
it's a line.
It's a line, just because it struck me as just being the funniest line, one of many funny lines in it, is the Christopher Guest line where he says, "Well, you should get some rest because if you don't have your health, you haven't got anything." It was just the mundaneness, whatever the word would be. You know, they're talking about murder and plotting.
I never actually know what the word is for what the gerund or whatever.
The mundanity
is
of it.
Mundacity.
I think it's mundanity.
But anyway, it's a funny line. It's beautifully delivered. It always just, it's the line that always sticks in my head. But there's 10,000 lines in this movie that are great.
And in case you missed this, I'm T. Christie, and The Princess Bride is probably in my top three favorite films of all time. You've been paused at the MGM logo fading to black for the last several moments, and now you will get your comeuppance. Get ready? Mouse or remote. 3, 2, 1, unpause.
There's too much. The line that I use most often in life, now that I have a moment to think about it, is there's too much. Let me sum up.
There's too much.
Whenever it's time to explain anything to anyone and you don't have time, you just go, no, wait, there's too much. Let me sum up. So,
a long time ago in a land far, far away.
You know
away.
Who was in this movie that I completely forgot about until just now? Fucking Fred Savage.
Fred Savage and Peter
and Columbo.
And Peter Falk. Yes.
Oh, just one more thing, Fred.
The kissing. The way they're kissing, they do. Now,
when you say you're sick,
Fred Savage, you know, just
I believe
just after the Wonder Years, if not
during.
This was his summer break from the Wonder Years.
Yeah, because after he was old and crusty.
Yeah. And of course, notice that, you know, this is very cleverly set up where Fred Savage obviously only had to be in this one set for probably maybe a couple of days of shooting at the most.
Right.
Fred Savage was a good little kid actor.
He's quite good.
He's
a perfectly good adult actor as well.
Battlestar poster there, I think.
I like the Groundhog Day background out there. Get your booties on because it's cold outside. It's like a Cosmo Kramer.
Yeah, it comes in like Kramer.
I hate that. Hey.
He's going to pinch my cheek. So what's especially great about this opening as a construction, and it's kind of taken from the original book, the idea, I don't think, help me out here. The book doesn't actually have this scene per se of grandfather reads to his kid, but it does have a narrator who says this is a story that has been retold 1,000 times and so on and so on. Is that, can anyone back me up on that? Has read the book more recently than me?
I've read the book many times in my life.
So it does not literally have, help me, or does it, literally have a scene of a grandfather in a, it doesn't have this in it.
In the book, it's actually a straight parable. Yeah. Only it does these meta jokes where
the narrator,
skip the next 60 pages.
But the narrator kind of serves the function that Peter Falk does in this, where he's kind of talking to you as your narrator.
Right. He's talking through the book to you.
Yeah, saying, no, maybe you don't want to hear this part and we'll skip it, you know, because that is from the book.
And not Peter Falk literally, or not the character of the grandfather literally, but there is a narrator that is helpful, and it basically posits, here's the greatest fairy tale ever told, and we're going to skip the parts where we talk about how people came to power. It's yeah.
Boring parts cut out.
For people that don't like books, and people especially don't like fairy tales, which I personally really appreciate and love the parable nature of them, but for people that don't ever get into stories this simplistic and this shrouded in parable themes, The Princess Bride is probably the best book of all time just to read it, and you're like, I totally, totally get this.
So it's like Lord of the Rings without the 60 pages about Gondor.
It's like Lord of the Rings without the book.
Dude, it was way more than 60
book about Gondor. It's Lord of the Rings without the words.
Oh, okay.
So
Princess Bride, William Goldman, Such a fan.
So the entire falling in love is covered in basically what's virtually a montage here at the beginning of the movie and the book. Because, you know, they fell in love. That's all you need to know. That's it. There's no more to that part of it. You know, they're in love. Now we tell the story. Goldman did write this screenplay, so we can presume that he, you know, added to make it a more literal beginning of being told a fairy tale and wrote the opening scene.
Right.
But what's so genius about that, whoever's idea it was.
Well, he did, in one of his books, he does say, like, his whole thing was, I'm only going to write the parts that I think are interesting. Yeah. I don't want to write all that bullshit in between. No, I just want to write the fun parts.
And even plaintively, he literally says in the, I think it's in the foreword, it might not be in the actual text of the book, but he says, this is a fairy tale with the stuff cut out.
Yeah, with the boring stuff cut out. Yeah. So.
Which is the origin of the whole idea of it being the abridged version, right? With the joke being that there is
the
no
joke
unabridged.
Is that it's abridged. There is no such thing as the unabridged.
And asterisk. We'll come back to that later.
But what is so brilliant about this as a movie and why I don't think the movie would have worked nearly as well without the grandfather modern day framing story is that immediately puts this in a context of, you know, you recognize that there's a filter to this movie, that someone is telling this story to us and we will have these gaps in time and we'll skip over parts and it's okay that it's kind of weird and disjointed sometimes.
It lets them get away with more than they would have been able to.
And it
otherwise.
Puts you in that frame of mind like you don't have, you know, this is not Shakespeare we're doing here. We're telling, this is a fairy story and it's, you know, it's like your grandfather would read to you. And it puts you into that mindset and I think it makes you accept the silliness of the movie when the movie gets silly more readily.
And it especially speaks to people like me, and I'm sure there's listeners that are aligned with me on this, where my favorite movies, whether or not this is a total causality of my favorite movies, but there's a definite correlation between movies that I love and meta narrators. Yeah. I love the concept of a narrator that is
that could be
not only telling you the story, but he's editorializing the shit out of it.
Something else about this movie that we've talked about this in other movies too, that no matter what movie you're making, you're pretty much guaranteed to kill it if you acknowledge that what you're doing is funny or campy or silly. And as funny as the supporting players are in this movie, they're the ones who are allowed to be kind of wacky and over the top. But Cary Elwes and Robin Wright here play this entire movie completely straight.
Totally straight. And by the way, a handsome couple.
A sweet couple.
You could do worse than Cary Elwes and Robin Penn.
You
in
absolutely can.
Holy
you
shit.
If they had a baby, it would have been the star child from the end of 2001.
It would have glowed. You couldn't have, like, you could read by that baby in the dark if they'd had a baby. But instead, did she and Sean ever have any kids? I have no idea.
I'm not positive, but they would have had long ass noses.
Saruman is coming.
Edit attitude.
I love the one, like, Chris Handel in the group that's juggling rings like an asshole.
You can see me in the background. Look!
I always wonder, does anyone know, has anyone been to enough Ren Fairs to know whether or not you can play multiple notes on a one tube Buell?
You can, because the trumpet works similarly. You can only do octaves.
It's all about the embouchure.
You know, it's just like a bugle. That's what taps is. Taps is just three notes at three different octaves. Dun, 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 dun. You know, that's, I don't know if it's strictly an octave.
I'm assuming it's the first and the fifth and then the first up higher.
But literally, it's just the tightness of your lips or the embouchure. Yeah.
And by the way, Michael, I know what an embouchure is because I play trombone. I have knowledge.
I do too.
Well, then how come you don't know how a fucking brass instrument works?
Because I played trombone when
hell?
I was a young...
As a young early. Lad. When he was too young, his parents didn't explain to him about the armature.
I was a
point.
Stud muffin. Go to hell.
There you go.
With your trombone.
Shut up! I was going to be in a ska band. Trombone. I was going to be famous.
Trombones are cool, man. They're bitching.
By the way, there's fog in that shot.
That's nice. Yeah. There's fog in the castle for some reason.
Robin Wright Penn, who went on to be Jenny in Forrest Gump for those not playing the home game.
Jenny used to be in Princess Bride.
She used to be in Princess Bride.
Jenny was
Bride.
A princess.
She said, "Run, Carrie."
My Forrest Gump sucks, by the way. I just discovered that.
And Chris Sarandon, brother of Susan Sarandon.
That's correct. Who really? Also
who is also the voice of Jack Skellington in The Nightmare Before Christmas.
That is true.
Which and, we'll be getting to in the movie.
And was in one of my cult 80s fave movies, Fright Night. He's the vampire in Fright Night, and I always liked him in that.
Chris Sarandon is I wonder why, maybe it's just that I haven't seen the stuff that he's in, but I want to see him more.
His heyday was the 80s. I think he's still around, but
I don't think he
but
died.
No one cares.
Yeah,
no one
but cares. The 80s was his big thing. That's a beautiful
if
forest.
You watch Inigo Montoya really nice. In the scene, he looks like a cutout. He doesn't move at all.
he's literally a standee of himself.
Not moving. Watch. Not yeah. moving and still not moving.
Wow.
Mandy Patinkin, Andre the Giant, and Wallace Shawn.
He's a freeze
Brian
frame.
Like, he's your favorite.
No, seriously. Even with like the gate weave on the film, yeah, it's he's like he's moving. In one place. He is pasted on after the fact.
He blinks. He did that in
he's an optical.
Brian, who's your favorite of the three marauders?
Wallace Shawn.
Wallace Shawn?
Wallace Shawn.
Does anyone disagree?
Inconceivable.
Inconceivable! Oh, no, actually, no. I just remembered, now that you guys just said that, I remember the line that I actually do use a lot.
Which is?
You use that word so often, yeah, I do not think it means what you think it means.
It's definitely 1001 household uses
Wallace
there.
Wallace Shawn, who's a playwright and a columnist.
And an actor.
And also the Grand Negus.
He's an actor. Obviously, you recognize him you basically know him from his voice. And occasionally when he's in movies as his head. But he was the boss in The Incredibles, and he was Rex in Toy Story. He gets a lot of Pixar work. Because he's got this perfect freaking animated voice.
Yeah.
He does have a great character voice. And Andre the Giant, of course, was in that world of, pro wrestling. You know, he became famous in pro wrestling. You know, earlier pro wrestling before it kind of became what it is now, but wasn't quite so
when they saw the pretense of it being real.
Yeah, and it was a little more low rent. I mean, now it's like this big thing with strobe lights going off, but you know, Andre the Giant, then you'd watch him on, you know, the local syndicated station or something like that, because, you know, wrestling, you know, who watched wrestling?
Sure, you got a problem with strobe lights?
I love strobe lights.
Okay.
I just don't think
as long as we're good here.
Let's move Eddie, forward like an,
hey, we got to pull conflict in this episode somewhere.
My point is that a sport that involves strobe lights, maybe not so much of a sport, is kind of what I was getting at. It might be more of an entertainment or a showbiz.
Have you
or a
never
circus.
Seen strobe golf?
Have you ever been to a full contact rave?
Yeah.
Strobe diving actually is pretty badass, but it's very dangerous for the divers.
Now, this is so. I want to curse, and I'm gonna pull back, because kids are going to watch this episode, because The Princess Bride is perfect.
They should.
This is so. Word? Adorable. This is so adorable, where he's like. There's this game between the simpleton giant and the slightly wiser but inebriated Spaniard, where his friendship is predicated on these rhyming games that he plays with this giant. And of course it results in the anybody want a peanut line, which is perfect. And it's been oft quoted, but it's such a bizarre, I don't know if it's William Goldman being a genius because he's William Goldman or just a cleverly used writing gimmick where you can get someone to like a character so much based on one simple trait. Based on one thing that they do that you can't separate from the character at all. It's just, that guy likes to rhyme because he doesn't know how to do much else. I mean, it's so freaking adorable.
It's what passes for Save the Cat. And although Inigo will have his Save the Cat moment all the more later when he allows Wesley to get to the top of the
Save the mountain. Cat, in terms of screenwriter.
Top of the mountain.
In terms of screenwriter theory, which William Goldman has had quite a say in. I don't think Save the Cat is his, is it?
No, it's Blake Snyder's.
Blake Snyder.
But it's
basically, yeah.
Bless his soul, blah, blah, blah.
Save the Cat is basically Blake Snyder going, hey, I read a bunch of screenwriting books and here's what I actually use.
But he's what I admire about Blake is that he basically turned it into a phrase that you can kind of say, like, save the cat, as opposed to, well, you know, the hero needs to demonstrate that he's worthy of our sympathy.
Brian, what is
Save the
Cat?
He's boiled it down to a concept of called Save the Cat, which is a nice, concise way of describing it.
Does Brian know? Or
yes,
we
I
put
do.
Him
I, was,
on the spot?
I was just yeah. waiting. I was being polite, waiting for trade to finish.
Brian just had this look on his face of like, oh shit.
Oh no. I know nothing about movies. You've exposed me.
And now here's Brian to explain it.
Hey, I'm only just now reading Save the Cat. So
it's actually one of the ones I still have to get to, although I am familiar with the concept, which is the sense that you give a character something to do immediately or very quickly in your story that makes you like them.
And you sympathize with that character.
So you sympathize, you connect, and you relate with them immediately. And it's whatever it is, but the perfect example is to save a cat or some other kind of animal. Because anybody that saves an animal is like, oh, okay, they can't be all bad, right?
If a hitman walks out of his house to kill someone but stops to, you know,
help the turtle across the road or whatever.
Then we still are supposed to like that guy. He's our main character.
A common example relating to that is Leon from The Professional, who has a plant.
Right.
Yeah. He has his plant. You know, that's his cat.
He kills people, but guess what? He keeps
care of
that
plant. That's pretty cool. I do like
the shrieking eels.
The shrieking eels. And that's a really good fantasy concept.
Or as well as Sean would have us believe, the shrieking eels.
Shrieking eels.
Now, when I was in college, we actually adapted this. We did this on the stage as one of our shows.
How did you do the shrieking eels?
We never showed them, but the sound effects.
They were a rock band.
The sound effect was
a. There was nobody there, man.
I saw them before they were even a band.
Yeah.
The sound effect was a TIE fighter sound effect, and nobody ever got it, and we were always disappointed.
Really?
It. Yeah.
Did you have to pay Ben Burtt?
Yeah.
I bet they got it and didn't realize they were supposed to. Find it funny. They were like, we're just gonna pretend just we don't obvious. Know what that is.
So I hope somebody on the way home is like, oh, that's what that was.
I love
that's
the allowances yeah. old ladies.
I hope so.
I love the allowances old ladies give to Moonlight Theater, Brian, don't you? It's a TIE fighter. No one will know.
I wish I could have been part of this movie because, you know, to have been able to do ROUSs and Shrieking Eels would have been, you know, that's quite something I'd like to have in my resume.
I guess we could have tapped into that because there is a fair bit of puppetry and animal stuff going on in this movie. Trey, how do you feel about the eels?
I like
the
how
RUSs?
They totally just cut around that. They're like, he grabs her and then she's in the boat.
And she's in the
like,
boat.
We never even see her
lift
or anything.
We'll get into that later, but Andre the Giant had severe back problems.
Yeah, he could not actually lift Robin Wright Penn in any of these scenes.
Ever.
It's always a cheat.
Trey, puppets.
It's fun. I mean, it works okay in this movie. I think there's only, that I can think of, there's only the ROUSs and the Shrieking Eels, and I'm not even sure the ROUSs exist. But the ROUSs are obviously little people crawling around in rat suits. I think there's some puppetry where they, like when it bites him on the shoulder and so
Danny
on.
Danny DeVito was in this movie. He didn't need a suit.
Danny DeVito in a rat suit. Patton Oswalt reference for those of you who missed it. It's fun. It's cheesy and cartoonish, but again,
That takes
me back to the opening where it's like this movie has already sort of given you the excuse to go, this is going to be a little silly around the edges.
Yeah, and these ship shots.
By the way, these ship shots before
Burbank gets in. Speaking of the ship shots, let me tell you.
Speaking of the ship shots.
Speaking of the point Mike was about to make.
Yeah. You see that point? You see that boat right there? There's definitely a boat right there. It's not going to be there in a second. Michael, go.
Continuity
problem? I was just going to say I liked them because are they model shots? They got
to
be.
It's hard to tell.
I think it's a full-size boat on a set with a psych in the background.
Because, there's something, but yeah. I'm like.
Well, that's a miniature there.
The water is scaled.
And that's
wrong,
a real,
but,
that's well, a real yeah. somebody like going up a real
and
cliff
here
somewhere.
Yeah. And they,
where's the ship? I don't see the ship. Now, the ship is gone.
Yeah. Well, but they just had a shot where it.
They sent it off.
Floated away.
It's funny.
They send off Bill the Pony in Lord of the Rings.
Of course, behind the scenes, what we know that means is they just had the one ship.
Yeah.
That's all it is. That's all it means. And now they're both gone, strangely enough, when you see it from above.
I love this, when you catch the giant pulling him up. There's such a clear wire thing going on here.
Yeah.
Where he's just floating up the thingy and barely, he's like holding himself up with zero weight whatsoever. He's just moving his arms. Like his shoulders aren't sagging at all. Things that reveal. When I was like, I watched this movie. I don't think we've touched on this yet in the episode. I think we may have talked about it, or I've talked about it with individuals between the group here, that when I was growing up, this was the movie. Between this and a fan film called The Formula made by Geeksa alum Chris Hannell, there was two movies in my life that I've watched literally repeatedly, and this was one of them. I had a VHS screen on my computer setup at the time was a dual monitor setup. One of them was a TV that was connected to a VCR, and every night I'd be on the computer on this side, and literally I only had one VHS tape, which was The Princess Bride, that I would watch at least once, underlying each word till your pencil breaks, every night for going on a year and a half, maybe 2 years.
Wow.
So I memorized, at a time I had this literally, and I don't mean this in a colloquial sense, the entire movie memorized. I can still, to this day, do the wine scene between Vizzini and the man in black.
I just got to point out the fact that whoever's standing in for Cary Elwes climbing that rope there is, he's hauling. Look, and he's not using his legs at all. That's pure arm.
Yeah.
And
a wire, I believe, for helping him. But
Well, no, I mean in the wide shot where it's definitely.
I like how the stones under their feet compress because they're clearly a styrofoam set. But
there's a worse one in the second during the sword fight where you can clearly see Manny Patinkin do a jump
land on a pad.
A
dust covered
pad.
Which
is like one half an inch under dust.
Yeah. Not only that, but when he does the gymnastic move off of a suspiciously clean and perfect bar that happens to be sitting there with a little moss on the edges.
It's fortuitous.
It's fortuitous. It's just the right spot.
Have you guys heard
totally almost stabbed Andre the Giant in that shot just then. Like, we wasn't looking and almost just killed him.
Yeah. Are you guys familiar with the stories about Manny Patinkin being kind of a crazy bastard?
I've heard.
I'm not at all surprised.
I've heard that fact.
As an actor, you mean?
As an actor. Yeah, because he was most recently on Dead Like Me, and I think I was reading trivia for that show. And apparently, he's one of those insanely dedicated actor types where he will, like, he'll break character if you ask him a question as Manny Patinkin, but he'll break character in a I will break your face sort of way where he's not amicable about
character.
He's not like just gliding between the character and himself. If you break character and say, "Hey Mandy, what time is it?" he'll go apeshit and stab you in the face.
Not literally.
No.
I don't think it means what you think it means.
No, Mandy Patinkin will stab you in the face.
He will stab you in the face. Wow. Okay, good to know.
I know he was on one of those cop shows. Was it Criminal Minds?
I think. Might have been.
Yes. And then he was replaced with Fat Tony. What's Fat Tony's actor's name?
I don't remember. Pizza the Hut.
Fat Tony from The Simpsons?
Yeah.
Joe Mantegna. Yeah.
Joe Mantegna.
And it broke my heart. The reason I bring it up isn't because, let's make fun of Mandy Patinkin.
Especially
it's more,
with the Compte Waterbank.
This movie and other things that, in fact, all these actors have done. This movie might be the one most cherished thing. Like, there's a movie every 20 years that comes along where it's like, that movie is insane and perfect, and people will, they won't even acknowledge that each other have seen it. They'll just go straight into the references.
Yeah. How could you not have seen The Princess Bride?
It's bizarre because I wonder how many other parallels it has with Star Wars where it's become a thing where people can reference it without context and everyone else is with them 100%.
Yeah, I would say so. This has definitely made its way into the popular culture.
Why do you think that is, Brian?
Start with somebody else this time.
No, you never get to talk. That's why he's making sure to.
Brian, why is this movie?
And you're trying
so
to ensure that he never does again.
I know.
Yeah, seriously.
Why is this movie so ubiquitously loved?
I don't know.
Give three examples.
It's certainly in
persuasive essay.
And
please.
Cite my sources. Hang on.
And show your math on a separate
proper
podcast.
Thesis here. It's certainly one of those perfect, you know, at least candidates, and I would say entrance for in the perfect movie Hall of Fame. It's one of the things that I find very interesting that this movie succeeds at, and I have no idea how it does, but it's like what you were saying earlier, Trey, and how it manages to it straddles this line between parodying itself and being funny, but also being completely serious, and it straddles this very particular line that I don't think I've ever seen in any other movie where it is both seriously and sincerely doing what it's doing and also parodying what it's doing at the same time.
True, yeah.
Michael, any theories?
I think it's gotta be the characters. That's what, you know, people are always bringing up, and they're very interesting characters. All of them are. I mean, all the bad guys, you know, Inigo and Vizzini and the Man in Black, Wesley, and you know, they keep running into new characters, and they don't repeat a character archetype. There's just something for kind of everyone to, you know, it's like Winnie the Pooh or something. Like there are all these different personalities, and there's at least one that you can latch on to and go, I love that character, you know? And I imagine, I don't know, because I've never actually done a survey, but I imagine that if you asked a bunch of people who their favorite Princess Bride character
is,
you would tend to get different answers, and it would generally in some way correlate to their personalities, probably.
I think there's a Freudian poll that goes along with that, too. Yeah,
and a MySpace poll, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah, there's two Facebook polls on which villain are you. Trey, why do you think The Princess Bride is this thing?
It's, you know, I'm like I'd be able to give a definitive answer to that question, so I'm just going to spitball. First of all, it's timeless. I mean, it's been around since, what, 80, when did this movie?
87.
87, so more than 20 years.
A fair year, year in which our host was born.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But other than,
all right then.
But other than the video game that,
that's
being played in the first frame of the movie, there's nothing dated about this movie because, of course, it's, you know, mostly a fairy tale. And if you look real close at the decoration in Fred Savage's room, you can find, you know, things that are 20 years old, but it's not about that. So it's not featured very heavily. So it's like, if, you know, no matter what age you are, even if you were born the year this movie came out, you know, you're able to discover it whatever age you do discover it, you know, and it's just can be just as relevant and fun to you at that age. So it's not like you had to be there to enjoy this movie. That's certainly part of it, that, you know, that no matter who you are, if you see this, then you have no reason not to like it. You can't go, oh, it's kind of an old ladies kind of a movie. You know, it doesn't have that problem.
No, it does very much all the classic tropes. If anything, you know, especially now that we're getting into this part, but it's very much like an Errol Flynn type of, you know, like the old Robin Hood, that kind of movie, you know, very consciously going back to like you say, very, very timeless. It's like I honestly, until we looked it up, I thought this was a much older movie.
I would have called this early 80s.
Not because
not
because it feels dated, but just because it does feel, because of the permeation and the culture and stuff, it feels like it's been around for a very long time. Mm. And, you know, stylistically, it's fairly straightforward. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because it's not wildly stylistic like a lot of movies we get today. But, yeah, there it was.
There's the mysterious stuff. Both of them. Yeah.
But because of that, it's harder to place, you know, than a McG movie will be 20 years from now. Yeah. We will know exactly what time that movie
or
was
a movie
made,
with bullet time in it, or something like that.
Exactly.
In the Watchmen commentary, we talked about with Eddie Doty, who is a fighter, the merits of this film, and now we're here with Dorkman Scott, who is a fight choreographer.
Knows a thing or two fight. About blade combat.
Eddie's opinion, as not only a fan of movies and as a fighter himself, whose opinion of this was in atmosphere, like, you know, stratospheric esteem. Like I said, how do you compare anything to the Princess Bride fight? And I think he said something like, you really can't.
Uh-huh.
Michael, how do you feel about this fight in terms of storytelling and in terms of swordplay?
Oh, in terms of well, there it is, that little moment.
There's that one very fortuitous bar.
But obviously, you know, now it's, you know, again, they're just being funny because, come on, dude, you know, he's not the fly.
Anyway. Jeff Goldblum is the
exactly.
He is no Goldblums.
Yeah, they haven't pulled out any Goldblums quite yet. I think this fight scene is actually quite fantastic, especially for pretty, you know, getting fencing style stuff, because it's tricky to do fencing because it's so kind of you know, linear. There are definite rules to fencing and stuff like that, and to keep it interesting and to keep it moving is very challenging. I'm totally blanking on the name of the guy who does all this stuff, but he worked on this and he did Lord of the Rings and Bill Hodges, I think is his name, something like that. Can't believe I'm blanking on that name. Yeah. But
what do we pay you for?
Yeah, exactly. No, I've got his book and everything, but I've suddenly forgotten his name. Bill Hobbs? I want to say Hobbs, but that might just be because I like Calvin and Hobbes. But what impresses me most is the bits where they're fighting left-handed, because they actually are. And as far as even if one or both of them is left-handed, then they're fighting right-handed for the other half of the fight, and that's just as hard. So that bit is actually very impressive to me, and it keeps moving forward, and it's very exciting. I really like that fight scene, and
there's no doubt that they did their training.
Oh yeah,
you know, at least to look convincing in their fighting.
Oh yeah, they did a great job, and if anything, I just wish there was more of it in this movie because they did a really good job.
Now I enjoy it very much, and it has that, you know, and tell me whether I'm wrong because you're more of the fencing blade expert than me, but it definitely has that, you know, style of choreography that's made to look fancy, because it's like, neither one of them is trying to like outright kill the other, which is in a real fight you would be doing.
Right.
You know, it's made to look like, you know, more of the art and the dance of it and a little more stage combat-y. But,
well, that's the whole thing.
Not
totally
that there's anything wrong
combat.
With that, but the, you know, and then the fact that it's beautifully done and it's all about these amazing exchanges, which wouldn't really happen in a real fight. You would look for your opening and make your stab and make the guy lie down.
In real life, stage, as opposed to stage combat, sword fights are over in essentially 3 seconds.
Yeah.
If you're good.
Right. If one guy's good. It only takes one guy to be good for the sword fight to be quick.
But, But that goes back to the question he asked about story and character. We've talked about this before. I think Eddie talked about this in the Watchmen commentary about, the fighting style has to show character and reveal something about character.
True.
Because otherwise you're just stopping the movie for like 2-3 minutes to have this fight scene, which works with the Jackie Chan movie.
In that particular scene, neither one of them wanted to kill the other.
Exactly.
They were enjoying the challenge of the fight.
Exactly.
So
you
they
get
wanted
away
to prolong,
it.
They wanted to prolong it and just try each other and test each other.
Exactly. Right? So it's, you know, all movies do the thing where they make it more about the dance and stuff like that, as you say, but, in this, the characters were doing that intentionally to kind of show off and be like, hey, what do you think of this?
Let me show you how good I am.
Yeah.
And the fact that, neither one of them has really ever met anyone who's as good as they are.
Right.
And was enjoying that fact. And then summed up by, you know, Wesley at the end by saying, I'm not going to kill you. I'd as soon destroy a work of art, you know.
Right.
It's like, I have no reason to kill you. So here's Andre the Giant, who, a very, very large fellow. Who, you know, would win his wrestling matches mostly by being very large and being, you know, no one, you can't knock him off his feet because he's too damn large.
Bob Anderson
is
the choreographer's name. I can't believe that. That's shameful.
Do you want to talk about
a name like Bob Anderson?
Well, that's true.
Mr.
Doesn't he have a steakhouse or something? I like to have his steaks. Oh, that's good.
This is a great sequel to look at.
Look how huge his head is. It's like a pumpkin.
He didn't come by the name by accident, Andre the Giant.
Yeah.
He's a big fellow.
He's a big, big guy.
He's a large French man.
And, of course, to his detriment, because as we mentioned earlier, and I guess we can go into it now, Andre the Giant had severe back problems later in his life, and he didn't live very long, obviously.
He died relatively young.
But he had, as a, you know, the various, you know, pituitary and bone structural problems that he had, caused him to have severe back pain, and he couldn't lift things, period. He was a wrestler for a while and then got to the point where he could no longer function as a, you know, behemoth, because just the nature of what happens when your body is that huge.
Yeah.
He couldn't lift Robin Wright Penn at the end of the movie, and when she falls into his arms, she's on a wire, and in this sequence he's I don't know if he's strapped up here. I don't know what it would be here. Maybe a double, or maybe he could handle that because he was just, you know, hunkered over. I don't know.
No. For the long shots, go back and watch it, because it's a great lesson in seeing a scene being edited between a double and between the actual actor. Because any shot where you actually see whoever it is carrying him, it's not Andre. And then for the close-ups, Cary Elwes is like on an apple box or on some kind of, you know. Huh. There's an assistant, so that Andre is not carrying the weight.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, that body double, Jackie Earl Haley. He knew.
Anyway, so
no, it wasn't.
In terms of seeing sequences for how to cut for body doubles, it's a good example. Yeah.
Now, this, of course, I believe it's the first time we've seen Mr. Christopher Guest in the movie, who will become very important shortly.
We heard him earlier when he was talking on the precipice up there.
Yes. That's true.
Here we go.
But yeah, but
is this really this early in the movie? Though?
Yeah.
We're actually half an hour in.
The most quotable scene probably of all time, and most people quote it and just quote it wrong. But if you get the gist, it's still within.
I'm sure
you can.
Oh, I'm so proud of myself.
But the Christopher Guest. I mean, we should point out we have yet to mention the very important name of Rob Reiner, who has a little bit to say about this movie. Rob Reiner being, of course, the director of this film.
Oh, the director.
Yeah, who actually has something, some value to import. In this case, I think Rob Reiner's main miraculous achievement was he didn't screw it up
at all.
You know, he didn't get in the way of the story and just told it. And there's not a lot of flash and nothing flowery, and he just got it done and got it on the screen, and God bless him.
We've probably got about 3 minutes to talk about Rob Reiner, and then a conversation will ensue. But let's spend this moment talking about Wallace Shawn.
Inconceivable.
One of my all-time favorite character actors. They'll always need a whiny, bitchy villain. I mean, you know, you always hear about...
Oh, Zoom and Dolly. Look at that.
Yeah,
there's a couple
Where's
sequences.
Your no flash now, sir?
Wow, he went all like, you know, geez, he went all Matrix on us all of a sudden there.
Michael, you might appreciate this. You're versed enough in old school, the Force.net visual effects tutorials to know.
Dear.
I went through
a
period where I didn't have a camera, and I was thinking, well, I can practice Force Lightning on real footage because I had that. I was mentioning a VCR setup that was my dual monitor. I could record that into the computer with a Dazzle setup that I had, which was very fancy.
Dazzle.
Dazzle Asterisk, I think it was called. And I recorded that sequence where Wesley is reaching straight out with his hand, and I used that still frame as my Force Lightning plate for about 3 months.
Aww,
Wallace Shawn in this scene basically sets a precedent for the remainder of his career where, guess what he does? He does angry, high-pitched, lisping guy. Like, that's his thing.
I'm not sure that's setting the stage for his career. I think that's
how he
exactly.
He kind of showed up there. He was kind of cast appropriately. Yeah. Really,
I don't think he ever walked into an audition or casting room.
I'd like to be
the romantic lead. Yeah.
Well, I kind of saw myself as the romantic lead.
I guess that brings up. And oftentimes in a movie, you can forget the casting director, but in this movie, everything is so great. I wonder, and I guess Trey is the only one that's read the book me and Trey are the only ones that read the book.
Ages ago, yeah, for me.
It's odd. I would not have come to, even if I somehow had the knowledge, having seen The Princess Bride, but obviously he hadn't been cast, I don't think I even would have come to, you know, that guy would have been a great Vizzini. I don't know who you'd cast as Vizzini.
Yeah.
He was just, obviously he was over the top even in the book, but, This portrayal, which is frankly just Wallace Shawn in a rag, like that's just him.
He's not even doing an accent of any kind,
that's
you know.
Just him, which has become along with, you know, Christopher Walken and William Shatner, a Wallace Shawn impression will get you into SNL.
Do the Wallace Shawn.
That's perfect. Absolutely perfect. And it's, I almost want to say that I wish I had seen him more in movies up until this point, but I feel like Wallace Shawn is another known quantity like Goldblum, where you can't really, if you have more than one Wallace Shawn every 4 years, you've kind of gotten sick.
That's too many Shawns.
It's too many Shawns.
It's an over Shawn.
You can see,
it's one too many Wally.
Yeah.
You can see Wally.
Quite a bit of him in, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, where he plays a Ferengi.
What is it with over the top characters?
He's kind of born to play a Ferengi, isn't he? I guess that was inevitable.
Yeah, he really is. He plays the head of the Ferengi society, and it really is a perfect, perfect role.
I'm so glad you called, because I've been thinking I was just born to play a Ferengi.
Wallace Shawn, who's a playwright, I guess, and also a writer and a columnist. Yeah, which is...
Big theater guy.
Oh, totally.
He totally moves like he's like a dwarf, by the way. The way he moves his arms, it seems like he's disproportionate. He's short, but he's not. He's just twitchy.
He's a little person, but not a little person. Yeah,
exactly. And I love his... You always see in movies these people that are supposed to be bald but aren't, so they shave their head in a bald pattern, but you can see their follicles, and it's like, oh, that's bizarre. But I love at the top of his bald Mount Rushmore,
that's for
beautiful,
real.
This crest of scalp, you see that little curly cue that he's got going on both sides?
It's adorable. It's very like Munchkin Land.
Yes.
Very,
oh, God.
Maybe that's why I'm thinking of it.
He looks so much like a carpet at the Mirage that it's almost bizarre to see him talking. But
and he has the dreamiest blue eyes. He does. They're like crystal
never go
pools.
In against a Sicilian when death is on the line.
And this moment perfect where he goes from alive to dead. Just freezes.
This is
and then
gone. And he's gone. He falls asleep like a baby in Monsters, Inc.
Great.
Now, it's almost like they freeze frame the film itself.
Yeah.
But then he just tilts
out. We also passed right by one of our great quotable lines is the land war in Asia. It's one of the great blunders is never enter into a land war in Asia, which when I saw this in the theater, that was definitely that was a way Homer joke. I mean, there was a definite beat of silence. And then the laugh came when people
finally got it. Did it play on a Vietnam War level with people?
That's what it was. That's what the joke meant to me and everybody else in the theater in 1987 was, it's 10 years after we can finally finally admit that Vietnam was a mistake. And that was a tacit little joke about it, that we can actually, it was finally not too soon to make a joke about Vietnam.
Someday in my life, I wish to be man enough to pull a River Phoenix Indiana Jones onto a horse, where you jump off the plateau onto a horse and ride off.
You've got to level up your manhood.
Yeah.
Just because of what you're going to lose.
Yeah, or get rid of it in advance. Exactly. One of the two. But if you can tuck it aside like a drag queen maybe or something, if you have that skill.
I do.
Oh no, you don't want to tuck it.
Yeah, that's true.
That's putting it right in the line of fire.
That's true. Fair enough.
That horse will destroy your balls.
Yeah.
So once again, here we are with in what is kind of a silly, campy scene on the page, but being played completely straight by these two actors, and it wouldn't have worked any other way.
Yeah.
And this
epic movie and whatever.
That's right. Yeah. Take
epic
a lesson.
Movie date movie. Does, yeah.
Take a lesson.
And this is a perfect example of where this straddles this line that I don't know how it succeeds in doing it. I wish I could figure it out, but it's both doing it completely with complete sincerity and parroting itself.
No, that's not a comedic scene though. No, no. Because what's happening is I think the movie the writing knows that it's over the top. The writing is being over the top, but the characters don't know it's
right,
over the top.
Right.
The characters are doing it.
Yeah. And that's what makes it work.
Yeah.
During that sequence, and this might be a really off the cuff statement, but
it's easy to get into that kind of situation, by the way, of taking it seriously when you're dressed like this. You're like, I'll say anything you want me to, and we can totally get away with it.
I will kind of fake a British accent, but not really.
Yeah.
Unlike other Robin Hoods, I can speak with
during
a British
that
accent.
Whole sequence. I was the whole thing between Wesley and what's her name, Buttercup, where I just keep wanting to say Robin Wright Penn. Because Robin Wright
at the time.
And asterisk footnote, because Robin Wright Penn. I was thinking, who would adapt this movie now? I went straight to, which is basically a punchline of that conversation. I just imagine Michael Bay making that scene.
Oh.
And it would have been this insane, you never know what true love is. Hans Zimmer score rises. Optimus Prime walks by.
You know what, though? At that level, it could also almost work. it's shot over the moon and come back again at that point.
It would still work if the actors played it straight.
Yes, if the actors
played it straight, you could do almost anything in the background or around them, and it'll work in its way.
I don't think anyone's ever accused of people in a Michael Bay movie not playing it straight.
Right.
They're trying. I think the problem is they're trying.
Well, yeah.
Sometimes.
The most part, at least the main actor, Shia LaBeouf and Megan Fox. I mean, they
yeah, obviously they we know what movie we're thinking of here.
Right. Megan Fox very seriously. Much knows what they're thinking.
But, well, the secondary character
realizes
are,
that she's in movies. I don't know if yeah. she's aware that at that level of things.
But I don't think Michael Bay, at least at this point in his career, takes it seriously. No. And you need the Princess Bride works because Rob Reiner is taking the material seriously as well. And
yeah.
Michael Bay certainly does
these
not.
These guys
at this
are
point.
Just actors, yeah.
Yeah, these guys and unknown actors at the time. I mean, they
which
you
is
know,
awesome.
It's this
what an amazing once again casting director.
This movie
Jesus
was very.
Christ.
If these guys, if either of these folks had been in anything before, it certainly wasn't you know notable, and they weren't known stars. They were both really unknowns as far as the as far as big you know movie stars. This really put both of them on the map. Enough that she was able to meet a very nice boy named Sean Penn and marry him for a while. And Cary Elwes went on
it's
to,
unfortunate.
Yeah, Cary Elwes went on to kind of, you know, spoof this character many times and do other things. He did the Robin Hood movie. He did the what were the Charlie Sheen movies?
Hot Shots.
Hot Shots, which also were kind of spoofy parody movies. You know,
and made an interesting semi-comedic turn in Liar Liar with Jim Carrey.
Yeah, and then showed up in Saw of all things.
Yeah.
You know, he's actually
disappeared for a while and then showed up.
Right,
in Saw.
Because you
he's
know,
quite a good actor. He's a great
want,
actor.
They don't want him to saw through his handcuffs. They want him to saw through his feet.
Yes.
Does anyone know if this is actually some place in England or Europe? Or
it
if
certainly looks like.
Oh, it's in England.
It yeah. looks very English.
Yeah, this stuff is in England.
And we, and
this
as
whole
we were saying,
reminds
that,
me. It's so bizarre. It's such a statement about looping because
yeah.
clearly there was no audio to be found
yeah.
on.
Yeah,
this
yeah clearly
location.
This was a bad day and they just had to get this shot because you look at them. They're like this blowing like hell right there. The wind is about to knock those guys off their horses.
It's straight up Ireland in that shot.
Yeah, it may well
right,
be here Ireland.
Another zoom, Brian. Look at this.
Yeah, ah! Very slick, very nice. But and also, it was, we were starting to say Christopher Guest, who this was after Spinal Tap, so he was at least known from that. And Spinal Tap, of course, was Rob Reiner's first movie,
first non-TV movie. Yeah,
yeah. And Spinal Tap was huge, and then he also had already done Stand By Me, which is what made people go, "Wow, that Rob Reiner, he can do a serious movie," even with Mr. Will Wheaton in it. And Mr. River Phoenix.
Hey, Wheaton.
Shut up.
What was the, it was the Family Guy that had that great parody. It's like, yeah, Family Guy did the Stand By Me parody
yeah,
where
yeah.
they go, yeah, the fat kid married, you know, the supermodel. That
they
he
got
married.
Richard Dreyfuss
to
come
that?
And do it again.
Can you believe
Can
that?
You believe it? No, seriously, that's not
he
a joke.
He married her.
That's not part of Family Guy.
Yeah,
that's
true.
The fat kid from Stand By Me really
married Rebecca Romaine. Whoever the hell it was, yeah.
No, it's Rebecca Romaine. Good
it
job.
Is Rebecca, formerly Rebecca Romaine Stamos of John Stamos.
By the way, there's a anyway. IMDb trivia would have us know that Mark Knopfler agreed to this movie, and he did, based on the one stipulation that they put the hat from Spinal Tap in, which is on his bedpost. Ha-ha.
On Fred Savage's bedpost?
You've got, exactly. You've got you've got your worth at it down in front this week. Come back next week for more
I have
single
an
pieces
hat.
Of Iron Man.
Exactly. I was gonna say the other one. We know it's in England because that was in the IMDb trivia too. Because the castle that they film in at the end was a castle that's been there since like the freaking, you know, the Normans invaded the country
yeah,
or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
So.
Actually, like most of their castles. That's what they're for is because, oh crap, here come the Normans. We better build a castle.
I don't know if you guys read this or not, but there was an article on Dig and I guess it made the rounds a while back about castles, actual castles, like it was the top 10 castles.
Uh-huh.
And, you see these and you're like, wow, that's actually a you know, stereotypical castle. And you recognize all of them from movies. And
yeah.
The number one is one, I think it's in Belgium. I might be wrong, but it's somewhere in Belgium or like on the border of Belgium, one of the other countries that you recognize from a bunch of movies. Not the least of which are Chitty Chitty Bang Bang and Spaceballs. It's that castle where you're like, motherfucker,
there's
that's
a
like castle. And you
yes,
find
it's
out.
Yes, very, very
and it was
German
made, exactly, yes,
fairyland
yeah,
kind
of
castle.
It's a straight up, like, you know, Resky sort of designed castle, like Excalibur, where you look at it and you go, Jesus, it's from all those movies. And you find out, like, the history of it. This article outlined, and it was really made by, and the answer for that one was, a guy in the 30s who wanted the castle.
Yeah, so it's not a real beat up nasty.
Oh, here we go.
Not a real castle.
Oh,
here's the William Goldman story. Now this particular edition that we're watching of Princess Bride has a commentary track by William Goldman. Which, if you have that edition, why are you even bothering to listen to us?
The fifth down in fronter is better than all of down.
Yes,
in front,
William Goldman, the author of this book.
Seriously, we're just ripping shit off the IMDb page.
Seriously, we have some opinions, but I'll tell one of Bill's stories that he told in one of his great books about. Finally being able to see this movie get made and being excited about the cast. And he was especially extremely excited by Robin Wright. He just, you know, she was, you know, the vision of Buttercup in his head that he'd had for 20 years, however long it was since he wrote the book, and to see her like in the flesh. And he was there when this fire swamp scene was being shot. He was on this set standing there watching it being shot, and he watched the two of them come through the fire swamp and just was just like, my God, my book is coming to life right before my eyes. And then the fire swamp jet went off and set her dress on fire. And according to Bill Goldman, he ruined a take by screaming, her dress is on fire, her dress is on fire. Yeah. And they cut, and everyone looked at him and was like, yeah, Bill, her dress is on fire.
You wrote that to
happen. That's the set it a go again. And he was like, but he was so just being there. He was so
freaked out.
Her
dress is on fire.
He was so enthralled by seeing his book come to life right before his eyes that he was literally living the moment. And when her dress caught fire, he was surprised because he didn't expect that to happen.
I don't know the answer to this question. And I guess that anecdote.
He was 42.
The way he says it in the book too is great. He's like, this is why they don't let me on movie sets anymore. Let me tell you why they don't let me on movie sets anymore.
Thank you, Michael. That's a perfect segue. I don't understand the answer to this. And obviously that anecdote would go a long way in a conversation following the question. But the question is, do you guys know why writers don't belong on movie sets?
It varies for the movie set. Some they very much are. Some they very much are welcome on the set.
Yeah. But
when the relationship is healthy, they're allowed. But when it's the studio, it's... studios and networks have a tendency of, well, the script needs a rewrite for some reason, and for whatever reason, their reasoning is that they can't give it to the first writer.
Yeah.
God knows why, but it's basically neuroses on the studio part. So then it's not allowing the writer on set as an outgrowth of that. We can't let the writers, because then he'll just demand that we do it his way, and what the fuck does he know?
Sometimes the director to be able to do whatever and doesn't want anyone else's opinion. You know, it's anyone, you know, if you're Rob Reiner and you're still a fairly early untried director and Bill Goldman, you know, is available, you should have Bill Goldman.
Right.
Because by that time, he was Bill Goldman. He was already a big deal. He'd won the Oscar for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and blah, blah, blah. And he was a big Hollywood screenwriter. So, you know, you probably can't not have William Goldman on the set of The Princess Bride. But there's no rule one way or the other. It's totally driven by the production and by the director and by how they want to handle it.
Yeah. Being a screenwriter is kind of like being a pimp. They're like, we paid you, so now we're going to fuck it as much as we want.
Yeah.
Like, that's basically what happens.
Right. We got 2 hours. That was the deal.
Which is an invert. Which is-
Someone put that on a shirt, right? Yeah. Being a screenwriter is kind of like being a pimp. We paid for it, so let's fuck it as far as we can.
Now we get to fuck it as much as we want.
Which is an interesting reversal from how playwriting is, how plays in theater is.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
you don't change shit.
Yeah. Whatever the playwright's words are, those are the words of God. Well, and you don't change them.
Unless it's an Andrew.
And strangely enough, it's
Reber play, in which case you.
Well, it's, and weirdly enough, television is the exact opposite. Television is writer's medium, and the director is the guy who can go suck it if he doesn't like it. You know, because.
Oh, that was a nice little flare.
Yeah. Very nice. A television show is, of course, you know, the people who drive a television show creatively are the writers who are there every week, and they've planned out the entire 13 episodes. They know where the story is going. The director is often a guy who just is there for the week to do, you know, whatever has been put in front of him. A director of a television show doesn't get to go, I had this great idea for your character, you know.
Yeah, shut up. Name one, name two.
Yeah. You're here to hang the drapes, pal. You don't get to, like, have ideas. So it's very much, you know, movies are just, it's just how it is. The movies are more of a director's medium and television is more of a writer's medium in terms just of who has the power.
It's just the way the system has grown into itself over time.
Yeah.
We're about to get into the sequence with the RUSs, which is
fantastic,
whatever. And here's your IMDb trivia. We dig deep. Rob Reiner is the voice of the RUSs, but whatever. But we're talking about the RUSs, and we can skip this sequence because, hey, who cares about puppets, right?
the RUS doesn't get him at this point. I can see you're concerned, so we can skip this part.
But there's a moment when Wesley's coming out of the sandpit where
now it's going to hump him.
Yeah,
and that's what's happening.
That's what makes it.
Oh, that's not right.
That's not right.
This is so
very
tongue.
It's
nice.
This is so very easy.
That's actually quite a good puppet. It's, you know, we don't care about puppets, but it's, you know, obviously, again, it's a guy in a suit. But you know, it's a good one.
Flipping around, yeah.
It's a good one.
Now, we can talk about the RUSs, and rightfully so, because one of our esteemed panelists happens to be a professional puppeteer, but we'll get past that.
That's
because
awesome.
Who gives a shit about Trey Stokes?
Well, you know, I don't like to... Oh.
Yeah. One thing I always noticed when watching this movie, repeatedly when I was in junior high, was that there's a... It might have been an editorial decision. Just the best take they had was this one, or it might have been something deeper than that. I don't know. In the book, Wesley represents pretty much impenetrable hero monomyth stuff. But in the edit here, there's a sequence where he gets pulled out of the quicksand, which we just saw. I guess it would be dry sand. Where he
the lightning sand, as they call it.
The shot they chose of Cary Elwes coming out shows him gasping for air in a way that is, it's clearly a human trying to breathe as opposed to the hero being like, I got this. Where it's the shot of Cary Elwes like, he's like really trying to breathe, which for one reason or another, and there's so many much more even subtly obvious and straight up capital O obvious things that they could have, that could have resonated with me as a viewer. But the one thing that always got me, and of the whole movie, the one thing that always got me is that shot of Cary Elwes, or the man in black who is now Wesley. Congratulations, Mr. Cary Elwes. You get to make out with Robin Wright.
And have two names.
And have two names.
She gets three, though, so what do you...
Screw it. You know, whatever. He gets top billing because he's got good eyebrows. The shot where he's breathing hard, and there's a shot where you can see, and it's not even so much... It might have resonated with me on a level beyond storytelling. It might have been with an actor thing. Because you can see that when he's inhaling coming out of the lightning sand, sand is going into his throat.
Mm.
he's come out of the sand. Clearly, it's a movie. I understand that even when I'm 14 and watching this movie and
well, he still
a lot,
probably was in a pit of sand for a few minutes.
You get in a pit of sand and breathe, that's going to happen.
Cary Elwes was in the sand as an actor, and they said, all right, pop out. He's half an inch under the sand, but that take where he's going, you can clearly see little specks of sand going into his throat, and he's like, between the portrayal of that and probably the actor's primary influence of, ow, sand, you can see this moment of pain and truly, like, this insane enlightenment. Like, oh, that flower is beautiful. I'm alive. This wonderful thing where he's...
Well,
he's,
it was real. It was
completely real.
And that's very real. I mean, that's the holy grail of acting, and that's the kind of the cliche thing is, I want it to be real, and I want to have a real moment.
Is this the hit coming up? The famous hit?
When the camera rolls, try to kill yourself.
The famous hit is coming up. Trey, tell us about this famous hit.
Well, the story goes, and let's look at it, is that when the scene where he's like, we're honest men and we should not lie, this whole lie about how he's going to be let go. He knows he's not going to be let go. And someone clips him on the head. The story goes that he got clipped on the head pretty hard. So let's look at
because
the shot.
He said, hit me as hard as you can. Just do it real.
You know, so let's see.
Cary Elwes said, please hit me as hard as you can, which is funny because you always hear about actors saying, no, let's really fight. This is funny because it's the one.
You don't necessarily, you may not have said hit me as hard as you can, but you may have said, don't try and
don't pull the punch.
Cary Elwes literally knocked out.
And it doesn't even look like much.
Dinged on the head by that big sword pommel, though. That definitely could ring your bell.
Went to the hospital for 2 days, and he locked out the production until he came back.
Ow.
Way to go, Christopher Guest.
Interesting anecdote from when we did this in college. Our Count Rugen was actually a female, and there was, it was our second night. Yeah. The second night was
played
the disaster night.
Sigourney Weaver?
I hope.
No.
She'd be an awesome Count Rugen.
Anyway, this particular night was an absolute disaster, and our Wesley completely blanked on his line, and because she was a woman, we had to change it, so instead of, you know, we're men of action, it had to be we're people of action or something like that. And he completely, just completely dropped the ball and was like, we're people, and We just don't lie to each other.
Or remember our lines, apparently. This is Mel something. He's a British character actor. You've seen him in 1,000 things if you've watched much British stuff. He's in a movie that I really enjoyed that was an 80s film that's actually quite funny called Morons from Outer Space. If you ever have a chance to see that movie, it's actually quite bizarre. And fun. And he's one of the morons from outer space.
That's my favorite explanation for the Jackie Earl Haley Christian Bale voice, which is this character just needs to clear his throat. It's not that he's that guy where he's talking like
you like the pit of despair.
The pits of despair.
Yeah, it's a great bit. You know, and obviously it's playing making a joke to the fact that those characters tend to talk like that for no particular reason. So he starts out talking like that and then clears his throat like said, no, sorry.
A matter of aside, I actually had a boss that talked like that once, and the entire time I was petrified.
I can imagine so.
You would be too. Don't judge me. That guy talked like death.
Teague, did you get the report, Tanya? No, I swear. I was just checking my email. Teague, are you on Facebook?
Now, okay.
No, I don't do that. What else? Yeah,
it's only a model. Mm. We've talked about almost everyone else. We've really kind of covered everybody, but we haven't really talked in depth about Christopher Guest.
We mentioned him, but we haven't gotten on him. But the movie's moving so fast.
You've been sitting there looking like a bored, silent puppy for the last 10 minutes. Talk about Christopher Guest. Do you have an opinion?
It's funny because going back and watching watching some of these movies again and having seen a lot of the other stuff, Waiting for Guffman and stuff like that, but before I was kind of aware of
was
know,
able to
actors
string
or whatever.
Actors
yeah.
together.
Like
yeah.
I watch it, I'm like, holy shit, Christopher Guest is my childhood. Like
he's in everything.
He's in everything from the '80s. It's crazy.
It's bizarre. The thing I remember him most from, and I'm the guy on the planet. There's 6 billion, maybe coming up on 7 billion people, and I still am the one guy that doesn't like Spinal Tap. At all.
Mm.
I just never made me think of
well, that's
funny.
Nitpicking, isn't it?
It is. It is.
But Spinal Tap goes to 11.
I see what you did there.
Thank you.
But Christopher Guest, the one thing I remember from is not Spinal Tap, but Little Shop of Horrors.
Sure.
Wow, what a fantastic plan.
See,
walks out. Like, that's his one scene.
No, until rewatching it recently, because I watched Little Shop of Horrors. I mean, I had noticed it before we did it for Down in Front, but I had watched Little Shop of Horrors, like, constantly through, not as much as you watch this movie, Fig, but I watched it pretty constantly, and not until maybe 3 years ago did I watch it and go, that's Christopher Guest, who just came in and started ranting about roses. I think he's great because he's, I'm surprised he hasn't gotten into TV either. You go ahead. What?
I was just gonna say this character played by Morgan Freeman.
Her?
Yeah. It's Morgan Freeman. See the mole? It's clearly Morgan
Freeman.
Oh,
I see.
That's true.
I'm like... Well,
those are his eyebrows for sure.
Andy Dufresne climbed through 500
yeah, exactly.
yards of foul-smelling shit.
Princess Buttercup was it.
Morgan Freeman as the crone. Yeah.
Sorry, Christopher Guest.
That would work. It could. He played an Irishman. He could play her.
Maybe that's why they call me Red.
Yeah. I'd listen to him rant at Buttercup in that scene. That would be awesome. And you know
Buttercup.
What? Let's remake it and make that happen. Yeah, I think Christopher Guest is great, and I like the kind of humor in the movies he does, Waiting for Guffman and Best in Show and stuff like that. I'm surprised he hasn't done more TV because a lot, like The Office, is very much in that vein. You would have expected him to show up on The Office by now.
Yeah. It's
or,
almost
or
like
the
especially
like that.
With The Office, that whole style
the
of
office owes
deadpan
a lot to him.
Improv
yes,
comedy. Really.
Exactly, yeah. exactly. And that's what's
at least
great.
The American Office, obviously.
He can go so... There are so few people who can be so ridiculous with such a straight face.
and
he manages to pull it off, and I love him for it.
It's funny. I had kind of, you know, grown with, although I didn't like Spinal Tap, I kind of grew with the Waiting for Guffmans and all that, you know, Catherine O'Hara and Eugene Levy, that group of people. That,
Second City and
the
that
Second
crowd.
City people that kind of grew.
Also,
I had
Rick
also
Moranis,
when I was
Rick Moranis.
When I was working at Blockbuster, I worked at the Blockbuster that Christopher Guest went to.
You're
going to
be Tarantino, dude.
But I was never there when he came in.
Aww.
But I was told that because he actually would send his wife Jamie Lee Curtis in, and she knew Blockbuster.
I came
out from one of my breaks one time, and she was ringing customers up to get them out. Like that's how often she was there and how cool they were with
What's
her.
Really interesting about Guest in this movie especially is that so much of his shots he doesn't move at all and everything is his eyes. He's if you watch him, just even when he's just in the background of a shot that's not about him, he's often completely focused on Chris Sarandon in a way that's almost a little disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes he doesn't move an inch, and it's just his eyes going from one character to the other, and it has this great intensity, and it's a great example of acting by doing virtually nothing as far as well, what's he doing? Well, he's not doing anything. But that's what makes it interesting.
He's a very I think what makes it work for a lot of the stuff he does is he is a very generous actor. Like he's not in there trying to be funny in the shot or whatever. He's like, I'm just gonna stand here.
And it's
because if I need to be funny, I know I can be, and so do the rest
of
you, but I'm just gonna chill for a little while.
It's appropriate for the character he is. He's Chris Sarandon's lackey. There's nothing for him to do until he's given an order to do something.
Right.
And until then, he's just, you know, coiled energy waiting to be unleashed.
He knows how his part and his role fits into the larger picture, and he's able to play to that. Which is not something every actor is capable of doing.
And at the end of the movie, when he gets to, like, you know, do what he wants to do, that's when he lets go. When he becomes
Okay, this is my scene, this is my time.
And flamboyant. Both as a character and as an actor.
Right. Trey, there was your line, if we don't have your health.
Some rest. If you don't have your health, you don't have anything. And I love it because, again, they're talking about the most heinous things. And you know that at some point Goebbels said that to Hitler. You just know that happened.
We're going to come up here in a second with I've been looking forward to this conversation since the beginning of Down in Front, which is the nipple torture sequence. But we're coming to there. We've got 45 seconds, and I'm gonna fill that 45 seconds.
Not to
with
50.
This. Once again, I was saying that I've followed Christopher Guest from my childhood, Little Shop of Horrors, and then growing up, Waiting for Guffman, sure, blah 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 blah. The one movie I was holding out on from the whole crowd was I never saw Best in Show until like 4 or 5 weeks ago, very recently, like last month. And Christopher Guest plays this bizarre southerner with a dog, yes. Like a blue tick dog.
And directed, of course.
That too. But Christopher Guest, and it's funny because I had all these weird disparate characters that Christopher Guest had played in my lifetime that I had never once thought, you know what, you have to be a genius to do that. And then when I finally saw Best in Show, it was like the icing on this cake that I hadn't even baked yet, where I was like, you know what? Christopher Guest is truly a genius. He's like Andy Kaufman, Dana Carvey level genius. Jesus Christ, that guy can do anything.
Best in Show has one of my favorite commentaries about that character, because there's a scene where he's just talking to the camera and he's talking about when he got bored as a kid, he would start like listing off the names of nuts. Like,
I remember that.
But the best part was on the commentary, because they're just kind of rolling and doing
stuff. I didn't know that many nuts.
He did. Yeah. He was like, I started doing it and I knew like the names of three nuts. The whole time I'm doing this scene, it was hard to do, not only because I didn't know the names of nuts, but because I'm distracting myself thinking, why did I start doing this? Like, how did I start myself on this conversation?
Seemed like a good
idea. When I was a kid, I thought this cameo was Robin Williams for one reason or another.
Seems like it should be.
I can see it.
He's fuzzy enough to be Robin Williams.
Trey, I feel unfortunate that we missed the nipple torture sequence. So talk about nipple torture.
What?
I'm trying to throw you segues that you cannot recover
from. That's right. He's under it. He lost it. He dropped it. Well, about nipple torture. Now you're talking about from a movie perspective or my personal life?
Your personal experience. How do you feel about nipple suspension?
If you don't do it right, you know, watch out. Don't go to 50 on your first night. That's clearly the lesson.
Or 11.
Or 11 even. That's not a good idea. Speaking of this guy looking like Robin Williams.
I love look at this. When she leaves, they're both like, and back to the knees. Watch. Ready? One, two, three,
and
down.
Back to the conspiracy.
I'm good. I got it.
Back to the conspiracy. So, yeah, Christopher Guest is great. And, you know, I often myself forget. I sort of just think, because it's his kind of movie, that Christopher Guest directed Spinal Tap, which he did not do. He appeared in Spinal Tap, and Rob Reiner, our current director here of this movie, directed Spinal Tap. It was, in fact, his first movie, his first real feature. And, he also did The Sure Thing, which is I've said that in some of the commentary, but I highly recommend The Sure Thing with, young John Cusack.
I'm sorry to asterisk here, but this crane move is insane. Other side of the bridge.
Under the bridge.
Up, over the bridge, looking down, and then they hold.
Yeah. With horses and
chickens.
Three dozen extras going around.
They were on the other side of that freaking bridge.
That's a hell of a crane.
At the beginning of the shot. It's like, Jesus.
That's Rob Reiner going, I can have a crane in this movie? Let's go. Let's rock.
Before David Fincher had soft homage.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, exactly. That's almost a shot that you shouldn't be able to do in real life, and yet somehow they managed to do it.
Now, I don't know if I would put The Princess Bride in any of my top list of movies, but I would definitely put Rob Reiner in my top five directors.
Well, A Few Good Men. You have a
A Few Good Men, American.
You have a giant I Want to Love You very seriously thing for Aaron Sorkin.
Of course. And so both American President and A Few Good Men put together is a pretty remarkable combination. I think they're both fantastic movies. Stand By Me, which we've already talked about.
It's funny. When I was, once again, junior high, Princess Bride, repeatedly, I always thought later when I saw Peter Jackson in director's commentary, like bonus features, I always thought, oh, it's the guy from Princess Bride in this sequence. Like, I thought that guy was Peter Jackson. And he kind of looks like Peter Jackson in his skinnier face, but
he let himself go.
But really? No. Not even kind of.
It's the hair. The only resemblance is the hair.
Yeah. And the hair. the facial hair as well. Yeah. That mustache.
I also had this weird preconception. This was probably honestly, probably a good 10 years before I got really drunk for the first time, that you could kind of finish off some sort of a drunken stupor with just dicking your head in, like, boiling water and cold water until it was
gone. I believe you mean dunking your head, yeah, just so we're clear.
No, I mean dicking.
Yeah. Well, it's not just this movie. I mean, you see that in, they did that Back to the Future, and they've done it in...
That's one of those movie trope.
Type yeah, thing. Movie trope. Yeah.
Where was it in Back to the Future?
The third one, Doc Brown.
They try and wake him up. He goes and throws himself in the horse trough.
They put him in the horse trough. Yeah.
Well, he puts himself in the horse trough.
He has some sort of a bizarre concoction, yeah. And he wakes up, goes to the horse trough, and then falls asleep.
It's the wake-up juice. Right. Yeah. It's actually because it's burning his throat, and he's trying to quench.
You have a back door in this place? Yeah, it's in the back.
It's in the back. But the issue is, I mean, you can at least bring someone around, but they're not going to be undrunk by this process.
Right.
You might make them conscious.
Right. The same way. 10 years ago, self, thanks you for that knowledge.
Yeah. The same with coffee. People are like, I'll drink some coffee and sober up. No.
They'll just keep you awake.
Just
to be drunk.
More awake.
Yeah, you're wide awake drunk at that point.
It'd be a really wired drunk.
People seem to have figured that out though, because now they're drinking vodka and Red Bull, because they seem to have realized that they can get the best of both worlds.
I guess we've talked about everyone else. So, you know, maybe not everyone else, but we've gotten to most of them. Mandy Patinkin. Who is just,
we've talked about him too. He's
retardedly good in this role. He's just so freaking good. And it's bizarre because when I saw this movie, and then I think I saw a subsequent movie where he had another Spanish accent.
There will be blood tonight.
You hear him talk, and he's
100%. That's not even a Princess Bride line. That's just great.
100% an American English accent. It's just like, oh, wow. So that was the whole thing you were doing.
Well, I was surprised that Cary Elwes was not British.
He's not British at all.
Because the two movies I'd seen him in, Princess Bride and Men in Tights, I was they just hired some British guy.
What else would he be?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Manny Patinkin's background,
so
of course,
saying
is
you're prejudiced against accents.
Yeah.
I'm not prejudiced against accents. I think British accents are awesome.
Manny Patinkin's
I'm prejudiced for accents, sir. It's affirmative action.
You're pro-accent. Yeah, he's pro-accent. Manny Patinkin's background is as a Broadway musical singer. I mean, that's what he does. And then
he's a singer? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. He's in Pirates of Penzance. He's in Sunday in the Park with George.
Pirates of Penzance. As soon as you said that, I'm like, now I buy it.
He's a Tony-winning Broadway musical star.
I'm surprised how many
who then sort of said, I'll try acting on TV movie thing.
I'm trying to recall, is there a play that makes reference to Pirates of Penzance that's not Pirates of Penzance? Because
there's a West Wing episode that makes it pretty heavy.
No,
they reference it on The Simpsons.
They're all about duty.
I saw a play where they were talking about, I want to sing and dance like the Pirates of Penzance, and I'd never seen Pirates of Penzance.
In my pants.
What the hell is that from?
Pirates of Penzance is one of those major, often referenced things. So I'm sure there are references
pretty much all over the place. Is the start point of musical comedy theater, really, Western-style musical comedy theater.
That and Real Genius.
Yeah.
I always confused it with the Pirates of Pinniped from SeaWorld. If anyone ever saw that show with the sea lions.
Which is a joke about that, you see. It's a play on the Pirates of Penzance.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
I've always known the word pinniped from that, though. I was like,
that's good.
Scientific classification.
It's bizarre the things that your personal etymology leads to.
I try to share those stories as much as possible.
It's funny what sticks when you're a kid. There's just the most random weird stuff will stick to your brain.
I did a show.
We've been drinking like rum and stuff, by the way. You guys were having a lot of trouble speaking.
I performed in a puppet show at the National Zoo in the summer of 1977, and that's why I can still remember to this day that the panda is crepuscular. So there you go. Zoo knowledge. Yes.
Trey Stokes?
No, it really is crepuscular.
Get
off my back.
I'm sorry. As Michael just made reference to, and now I'm willing
to
embrace.
Not the 50.
We're all just a fair bit inebriated. What the hell is crepuscular?
comes out at night.
Active
at night.
So
isn't that nocturnal?
Yeah.
It's also crepuscular.
Oh, all right.
Wait, so is crepuscular a subset of nocturnal?
I couldn't go into that much detail on it with you right now.
All right, well, you guys quote this movie,
you
and I'll be over
Wikipedia
here on Wikipedia.
And you get back to me.
And feel free to break my heart that what I think I know is not true, because it wouldn't be the first time.
what I've known for the last 20 years.
Everything I've known is wrong.
I love this line, and Andre the Giant has this whole thing, and it's bizarre because I no longer, although I grew up with this movie, as we've mentioned before.
Established.
Jason Segel.
Yes, we've covered that bit.
Jason Segel from How I Met Your Mother and Forgetting Sarah Marshall and a number of other Judd Apatow movies has the amazing monopoly on Fezzik for me, where really? It's like he has this insane Andre the Giant impression that sounds so much like Andre the Giant that you, the way that Kevin Pollak monopolized like James Kirk and Christopher Walken, where it's like, oh yeah, or Dana Carvey with the original George Bush, where it's like, oh yeah, that's what they sounded like. I have the same thing with Jason Segel's version of Andre the Giant, where he's like, everybody blue! Where I no longer associate that line with this movie, but I associate it with the iterations thereof.
That's a nice sword.
A very nice sword. Crepuscular. A very nice shot for it.
Just here's your down in front learning for today.
Hurt me.
You're very close. Okay. You're very close. Nocturnal and crepuscular are different because crepuscular animals are mainly active during twilight, dusk, and dawn. As opposed to nighttime.
As opposed to full night.
Or they'll come out on, you know, a bright full moon.
Okay. So these are golden hour animals.
So it's, yes. It's more like
magic hour.
It's more like, it means it's the same as nocturnal in that not active in the day.
Yeah.
But then there's shade. So it's more specific than nocturnal.
Exactly. In fact, the article even says a lot of animals that are casually described as nocturnal are actually crepuscular.
Yeah. So there you go. It was the answer to a trivia question of a puppet show that I performed.
I always thought that was very funny. Trey, the way he just rams into the knot.
Trey, I'm desperately afraid that one time you're going to be doing a down in front commentary and you're going to have a Diet Pepsi and a White Russian and come across the meaning of life. And we're all going to be like, yeah, like, sure. Just like, and later on, like,
it'll be on the tape, man.
Did I ever mention that when I was 17, a guy told me the meaning of life? Did I not mention that? No, it goes like this. It's very simple. So.
And then, of course, as would always happen, we'll lose the file.
Now, let's go ahead and do another classic down in front around. Brian, when the first time you heard this, did you have this weird moment where you're like, oh my god, they killed the lead character for real? Did you ever? Because when I was a kid, I totally bought that.
No, I don't remember that for this movie in particular. In fact, I don't remember my memory of first seeing this at all. I'm sure it was when I was a kid sometime. But I do have that very specific memory for another classic that we've mentioned several times, Howard the Duck. I remember when Howard died.
We gotta just do that movie.
Very much on a par with this movie.
Somewhere in this club, Leah Thompson is having sex with a duck.
I was actually taken in at a fully grown age when I saw this movie by the fake flash forward to her having already married the count, and then suddenly it's a dream, and he goes, the wedding was still 3 weeks off. I was like, oh man,
oh, you got me.
What a psych.
I was so stoked that the ending was gonna be sad.
Yeah.
But Michael, did you ever have a moment where you were like, they really killed the lead character?
I don't recall ever having that moment. I think I was more like the grandpa. I was like, will you shut up and let him finish? Like, come on.
Well, of course, the grandpa himself.
You know it's a fairy tale. Come on. And it's like Sleeping Beauty or whatever.
Grandpa himself almost immediately says, he's not dead, by the way. I mean, that's the next line is, you know, he's not actually dead. I want you to know that Wesley's not dead. Which leads into one of my favorite exchanges in the movie is when Peter Falk then goes, who kills Count Rugen? And Peter Falk goes, no one kills Count Rugen, which makes you go, wait, what? You know, and of course, because what they have in mind for Count Rugen is so much better than killing him and so much more fun.
All right, Brian, we've got Billy Crystal on the screen. He's going to say about 25 one-liners and then leave forever.
Yeah.
In the beginning, you said,
an indelible mark on movie history, you mean.
In the beginning,
you are the Brute Squad.
We all had these one-liners from Princess Bride, and yet yours had related to this character, the magician, the old Count's magician, Max, played by Billy Crystal. Why?
Well, part of it is
Max
because...
Max Wazowski! Anyway.
Wazowski!
I'm with
Mike
you, Michael.
Wazowski.
Part of it is because that's the character I played when we did this in college.
The circle is complete.
It's all falling into place.
You follow Billy Crystal?
Huh?
Give us a line reading. Give us a.
How did you approach this character?
Give us a line reading.
We just did the movie, so we did. I just did a Billy Crystal impression.
That's fair enough.
But I mean, what we did was my friend Amanda played my wife, played Valerie in this, and we just walked around on our knees and just did the scene.
On your knees? Yeah. Are they supposed to be dwarves?
It's just another day in college for old Brian.
Yeah. Okay.
Ooh.
It wasn't aeronautical college, so what the hell?
At that point, it was still...
Hey, you don't know what the ratio was like there, man.
Well, not never, never. Anything goes.
They had so many girls that Count Rugen had to be a girl. That's what I can't figure out.
Well, in the theater company, yes.
That
was our main line of advertising for the theater company at that school.
We actually have girls. We have real girls.
No other club on this campus has girls.
Take that, Shakespeare.
We have girls playing girls' roles.
And also Carol King.
Carol Kane.
Kane?
Carol King wrote, Tapestry and other famous
70s I'm very familiar anthems. With their works, Trey. Shut up.
Yes. No, Carol Kane. Yes, Carol Kane.
Not really.
Lotka's wife from Taxi. She was kind of most known for at this point, but had done a lot of movies. One of those wacky comedy actresses.
Trey, this is a bizarre... I know that we're in the middle of The Princess Bride and we want to talk about William Goldman, but, I mean, how do you feel about this old age makeup? Because, frankly, I think this works 100%.
It's good. It's a really good old age makeup.
Oh, yeah, this
makeup.
Is good makeup.
I don't know who did it. We'll have to look at the credits. I don't know who did it.
I guess this is a hypothetical slash theory question, but do you know why it works?
Well, let's see. I haven't looked at... This is also, by the way, I'm looking at a spectacularly large television, so we're getting a very good look at it, too, which is very nice.
Thank you, Shrey.
Although it's not Blu-ray. We might see the scenes
if it were Blu-ray. Yeah, if we see a Blu-ray, God knows what we'd be seeing. But
I think part of the success might be that they kind of... They don't get too close to his eyes.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking right at his eyes, so you would notice the seam, but they stay away from it, which gives him a kind of a sunken look, which happens to work for this.
Surely
guy.
The eyebrows are covering a multitude of sins. Yeah. You know, that helps. Carol Kane, they've definitely done a job on because she's actually a very attractive woman, or it was at this point. I mean, I don't know what she looks like nowadays, but, she's actually very cute. Yeah, now she just looks like this, but they did a hell of a job on her here. She looks quite scary.
You say eyebrows. Is that generally a thing where you can go to first to kind of cover the problems of
makeup? Well, I'm just assuming, but, you know, the makeup has to join around the eyes.
I'm not listening.
Yeah, I'm not listening. Around the makeup has to join the eyes somewhere, and certainly if you're going to add big bushy eyebrows on top, you have an opportunity there to hide the join up top. Underneath is harder because, of course, that's, you know, you can...
It's funny because I think of the
I think it's well painted and well lit. I mean, it's just all around.
It's well
executed.
It's not hugely thick either. I mean, this is not, you know, it's not like Billy Crystal's unrecognizable there. They've given him some jowls.
And a big nose. Yeah.
Well, they did do the nose. But, there's not a lot of big thick stuff going on.
I think of the quintessential insane old age makeup in cinema history as Yoda. Who didn't have extreme eyebrows. So I'm kind of curious.
He also didn't have a face.
Yoda's not a makeup.
He's not a makeup job.
Yoda's a puppet. But there was no eyes that they had to glue onto.
I'm curious, do you have any insight as to why eyebrows sort of let you cover the remainder of the eye raccoon?
I'm not talking about the raccoon. You're not going to put latex on a person's eyes. The eyes will be the person's eyes. Well, somewhere the latex has to start. So the easy answer is to put it at the eyebrow line because you're going to put eyebrows on top of the joint at that point. You know, you have a way to hide it. Under the eyes is more difficult. There's real experienced makeup artists who do that kind of work, which I'm not one of, but I've seen it done, and I know the basics, but I've never...
This kind
of
scene is really... You got to respect, sorry, but you got to respect Cary Elwes for a scene like
that,
because you know he's cracked up.
And also the fact that he just, you know, he has to just lay there and let them thrash him back and forth.
Yeah, but you know when he was just leaning up against Mandy Patinkin, there are like at least four shots where he just cracked up.
Yeah, how many blown
takes were there? And I love the in-between edit moment where he swallowed a fist-sized hunk of chocolate and magic.
Yeah. And somehow swallowed it. I'll have to say that there's the quotable line here, which again, in the great scheme of things, is not necessarily so quotable, but I find use for it in my daily life, and the people who are the right kind of people recognize it as the quote, which of course is the true purpose of quotes, because you want to find out who your friends are, which ones are douchebags, right? So if you don't know the Princess Bride quote, you know, and you'll test your friends, you'll start with a really hard one, and you know, oh, she's good, you know, if someone picks up on that. But anytime, and you'll... If you look for it, like I do, because I'm an idiot, you'll find an excuse to use. Well, why didn't you list that amongst our assets as an opportunity? There's plenty of opportunities in life to say that line. I got a six pack in my car. Well, why didn't you list that amongst? Yeah, whatever. Just you'll find the opportunity. If you look, you'll find. Is my point.
Michael, do you ever have that as the preeminent screenwriter and story conceptualist of Down in Front? Do you ever have that moment where you go...
Confabulist. I like that much better.
Do you ever have that
there
moment
you go.
Where you're
Draft
thinking,
two, right there.
Where you're thinking, this is a line that will probably be one of the lines from the movie. I should make it as thematically relevant as anything can be and give it something that...
What do you mean?
Well, in terms
when
of...
When you're writing a screenplay, all the lines are lines from the movie.
Yeah, each one is polished gem. Are you saying, do you know in advance, this is going to be so quotable? This is going to be the one that people are going to be saying to each other 20 years later on the internet?
Trey's making a joke, and yet, yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, do you ever go into a state of mind where you're like, this has to be something that can be so universally applicable that I can use it in anything, and then therefore hope that people in the future will?
Oh, no, no. Like, doing that on purpose? No. Like going into it and coming to a point and saying, this is a line that I'm going to make quotable? No. More often than not, what'll happen is I'll be writing along, and when it's going really well, the characters kind of take on a life of their own, right? And they literally start saying things you did not expect that they would say. So my favorite part is when a character says something that makes me laugh because I had no idea that it was coming. And then I'm like, that's a good line. I'm keeping that. No matter what happens, I'm going to find a way to keep that line. And that's the way it happens. Like, I think I haven't gotten any of them produced yet, so I don't know if it's true, but my feeling is that when you see them, you're like, that's one of them, you know, you hope at least, or otherwise it's just funny to me. And like in all the test screenings, like no one's laughing at that line. Well,
as often said, I was just reading David Mamet's book again the other day, and he said, you know, that some people use the phrase kill your darlings or kill your babies.
Yeah, kill your babies.
And it's, he says that, and I've encountered this a couple times, that the thing that I think is the funniest joke in something turns out to be the thing that I probably should have just cut.
It can be either way, where he's like, oh, people are going to love this and nothing happens. Or it's like your most hated line in something.
This is very well known.
Is what everybody comes with. Yeah.
And this, of course, is Peter Cook.
Oh, God. I hate when that happens. I hate when I hate a line, but God, I can't get rid of it, and everyone else loves it.
That's it.
I have had occasions where I write something and it makes me laugh and I'm like, oh God, I love that, but it's totally going. It's not going to stay.
Can't keep it. Yeah.
Or you'll keep it for draft after draft, exactly. But then eventually you'll have to admit that it really needs to go.
It has no place anymore.
Now there's two ways this can go. William Goldman being a name that you can go, that guy either is a insanely talented writer of all things, structure, story, dialogue, or he's just a guy. He's just a person that happened to know what people hone in on. Do you think, because of the nature of this movie as a movie that is quoted, has been quoted for the last 20, now 2 years, do you think it's one of those things where he was writing lines where he's like, that is so perfect, I'm going to write that? Or do you think he
was aware of his own genius,
exactly,
is what you're saying?
Do you think he stumbled upon all these, there's like 15 lines in this movie that people can quote, which with no context, with no reference, that people go, yeah, that movie fucking rules.
As I recall from what I've read that he's written about the process of writing the book and then making the movie, he did sort of, and the reason that he was so protective of it for all these years and until the right people came along and said, no, we'd like to make this now. He spoke of it kind of like Tolkien always spoke about Lord of the Rings, where he said, it's almost as if I didn't write this. It's almost as if like some force came and just used me as its conduit to get this story on a piece of paper. Sometimes he doesn't necessarily acknowledge like, yeah, I really worked hard on that script. He was like, no, this is just this thing that just came out of me and has always been the most perfect, effortless thing that just, you know, the one time in my life when it wasn't like a struggle to get something written on the page.
I have to say the combination of Andre the Giant's voice plus the bad puppet flailing around in the flames, that's always made me laugh. And I don't think it's supposed to be as funny as it is.
The first time I saw this movie, I don't think I understood a single line that Andre the Giant said. I don't think I got a single thing.
That could totally have been Robin Williams just
that's
then.
That's sort of a bizarre thing to step in on, because to be honest, I think you're right. I don't think I ever understood anything.
It took like
saying.
Three or four viewings to but go, I get that joke now that he said what he said.
I honestly think, and there's probably maybe 3 dozen lines that Andre the Giant has in the whole movie. He's not a main character.
I mean,
I think the only one I got was,
anybody want a peanut?
And I promise I didn't know what the hell that was the first time I saw the movie. I didn't know what that phrase was. Now we should point out again, just for your, you know, further viewing, he's already left the movie and he's gone. As he spilled, the impressive clergyman, is literally his name in the credits, but that was Peter Cook. And if you don't know who Peter Cook was, Peter Cook is one of the greats of British comedy.
IMDb time.
He sort of predated Monty Python. A lot of the Monty Python guys will tell you Peter Cook is the greatest guy in British comedy. And, he and Dudley Moore had an act that they would do for years that was great. And the Python guys were all involved. But it was so great. I've been a Peter Cook fan for decades, and it was so great to go, that's Peter Cook there. And he's been gone for quite a while too. So it's one of the last things he did, really.
Really good, on guard from Christopher Guest there too. Like you said earlier, you can tell they did the training.
Yeah, they did their homework.
And again, this be a real. I love that.
Well, what's so great about
this is a real castle.
Yeah.
Again,
what's so great about this whole finale is that
not a real castle.
They've set it up so that you know kind of what's going to happen, and everything happens in a satisfying way, but not everything happens in the cliche way that you think it is. Wesley does not have a final showdown with the bad guy. He basically talks him into chickening out. There's no final fight with Wesley. The only guy who gets a final fight is Count Rugen and
Inigo Montoya.
And Inigo, and that's for you. So you get that. You don't feel cheated that you didn't get to see somebody have a final fight.
Right.
But that's there.
But also that's because ultimately, even though Wesley is the hero, ultimately this other guy is the villain of Inigo's story.
He just comes up, does it, and walks away.
Yeah. And there
you go.
And our main bad guy, it's already been spoiled for us that the bad guy isn't going to die, which seems like it's a strange thing, but then we are still satisfied by the ending because we realize that it's even better than killing him, what happens to him. And this great concept of to the pain, where basically Wesley just talks the guy into giving up. Which is, it's really fun to watch.
Now, all four of us here at the table have written screenplays, some of us more than others. And there's a there's a moment where you realize the genius of The Princess Bride. And when you distill
with
it.
With every screenplay.
Sure.
I get about 50 pages in. I'm like, God, Princess Bride is a good movie.
Why was I'm going to so watch good? Princess Bride.
While I'm working on my cop thriller. I can't even touch Inigo Montoya.
Go on. Anyway, finish your thought.
Dorkman's right. Because then you realize The Princess Bride is like, God. Yeah. You know, Goldman's wrote a lot of books, but frankly, he's actually good at this. But there's a moment where you realize the hero, obviously there's this, I hesitate to say underwritten, but there's a hero of The Princess Bride that doesn't matter. You don't care so much about the man in black and the woman. It's more about all the tertiary characters, but there's a moment you realize, holy shit, the villain he wrote in the first act becomes this person that everyone's rooting for. And it's hard to ascribe a value to the character where you're like, I wrote this guy as the guy that's going to dispatch the person that we're supposed to be following in the first act. And over the course of the movie, he's become this person that we all root for. And the value of that, and we talk about this as if it didn't exist on the IMDb trivia page to begin with. But there's this whole thing where Inigo Montoya, the Spanish character, Mandy Patinkin, is played by this, he's this guy that has had this whole history that they wrote into like two sentences in the beginning of the first act. Like, He's on the thing, sword fight, blah, 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 blah. And that's the whole thing, blah, 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 goes on. But he has this whole backstory, and in the IMDb trivia, as it will be, wanted to tell you, but if you read the book, the whole sword fight is literally the exact same parry thrust injury that took place in the original, way before the story even took place, fight between Inigo and the man with six fingers. Like, it's the exact same shoulder, cheek thing that happened between him and the other guy, where it's like all of a sudden this person that when I first started watching this movie, I realized that's the bad guy. And he's fun to watch. He's funny. A character actor is playing him well, but he's the bad guy. That guy, it becomes this person that by the third act is this insane, weird antagonist that I totally feel for. And, partially because of Mandy Patinkin's genius as a crazy actor, partially because the writing has put him in this position where we so much care for this villain that against the other villain, he is this insane antagonist.
Well, he's come over to the side of good by this point.
I don't think I'd noticed before that he's just parrying into himself.
Yeah, he's not blocking the wounds. He's only preventing himself from being killed.
Right. But I have to say,
but for the record, the exact same injuries as was given to Rugen in the previous story.
No. The IMDb is saying what he's about to do.
What he's about to do to Rugen is exactly what he got the two on his face when he was a kid. He just got two in the shoulders, and he's about to do the same to Rugen and then stab him through the heart as a finale. So
that whole thing was wrong. What you just said.
Yeah. Well, you're on the right track, but it's not like.
But the as to the second part, I think. We talked about it. There we go.
Yeah, there another it is. And now, yeah. Now we're even. Now, he's going to give him the cheeks next. And
I think we find out pretty quickly that he's not. He's a good guy who
he's
fell in with
in a
bad
situation.
Crowd. Yeah,
he's a mercenary.
We get the save the cat moment like we were talking about because as soon as he's fighting Wesley, it's like, okay, you're not actually the bad guy.
Him letting Wesley up and not just killing him outright is the save the cat moment.
I will take advantage of all the much more intelligent points that you just make and say that they're part of my original thesis, which is that.
Well, yes. I mean, it's great screenwriting that
the original villain becomes this.
Well, the villain's Vizzini.
Well, there's
all kinds of levels of villains. Vizzini was vanquished. He was a villain, and he was killed. You know,
he was vanquished immediately. Yeah. pretty much right at the outset of the movie.
He got to have a great scene, but then he was vanquished. You know, right. Count Rugen gets vanquished. He gets killed. You know, the prince doesn't get killed, but he's still defeated.
That's what I mean.
And
I
the other two are converted to the side of good. So, you know,
that's
they're all defeated one way or the other.
I mean, in the good writing, it's the, you know, reverses as the term tends to go. It's like, you think it's going to go one way and it goes another. And it's constantly doing that. Oh, Vizzini's our bad guy. Nope. It's half an hour in and he's out. Yeah. Like, oh, Inigo's the bad guy. No, he's actually kind
of
cool.
He's actually pretty good. He's one of the good guys. You know, and the giant is one of the good guys now. It's like, well, wait a minute. Who's the bad guy? Well, good.
And if you view it in the sense of the story is just having a character set up and then there's a whole bunch of obstacles that they have to overcome. Then you don't even have to look at it in the frame of good guys and bad guys. You just, here's Vizzini, here's Inigo, here's, the giant. There's just obstacles for him to overcome, and he overcomes each of them in different ways.
And it comes back to framing this by saying it's a fairy tale, and by not really paying that much attention to how Buttercup and Wesley fell in love or any of that stuff, because none of that matters. Like, we know that story. You know, they're the perfect couple. They're going to fall in love. How are they not going to end up together?
Right.
It's like there's no surprise to be had.
Right.
Unless they're going to make this be a weird downer fairy tale where they don't end up together or one of them actually dies. It's like no matter what happens, you know they're going to end up together. That's a given because it's a fairy tale. So the interesting parts of the story are everybody else and how they resolve and what happens with their characters.
That and what you were talking about with Vizzini being out in the first half hour goes back to that other point we've also made in the past where a good story – you should have no idea where a good story is going at about the halfway point. A story should, if you have a premise, there should be a logical, okay, well, if you do that, then you would probably go there. That makes sense. That would be logical. And if a storyteller really does their work and really puts the time in, you'll get to that point, hopefully in like the halfway point, or definitely by the end of the second act, where hopefully by that point, as the audience member, you're like, okay, they've already gone everywhere where I think they could go, and I have no idea what's going to happen
next. And
yet
they're going to go somewhere else. Yeah, right. They're ahead of me. They're smarter than me at this point. The filmmakers are smarter than me, which is what you want to see, which is why this scene is so great and such a brilliant idea is, normally, and it can work just fine, normally you want to have these two characters are going to have their knockdown, drag-out fight, and it's going to be the most awesomest sword fight ever. Instead, what they do is he basically talks this guy into chickening out of and quitting the fight before they even have one, and then gets to put the last little comeuppance on it is once he's given up and they tie him up. Then he finds out that he could have killed Wesley because Wesley was unable to fight.
He's just bluffing.
He just basically talked him into chickening out, and that's even, you know, that's almost worse than just being beaten in a fight.
Yeah.
Well, I know we've made that point before as well, where when you truly defeat a villain in the most satisfying way, you not only beat them, but you break their spine.
Yeah, exactly. You show them that,
you show them that everything they fought for and believed is wrong.
It's the Joss Whedon, you know, the operative, concept. It's like, we're not going to kill him. We're going to make him go, oh man, did I fuck that up?
Was that a waste of time?
That's how we're going to defeat that guy. So. Now, here's a scene here, and if you look closely, you can see it. This is another behind-the-scenes story that I read from Rob Reiner, who when they actually ride out of the courtyard, there's a shot from this high angle when they ride out of the courtyard. That's not actually Andre the Giant on the horse. You'll see it's a much smaller person wearing an Andre the Giant sort of suit.
It's like the Headless Horseman type suits, like the arms are way too low on the sides.
He's wearing the costume, but it's clearly not the same size guy. And that's because no horse could carry Andre the Giant, because why? He's a giant. So, and nor could, you know, just neither could he actually lift Robin Wright Penn here. You know, he's like, they have this sort of stage this and make it possible to look like it. But anyway, in this quick cut where they ride out, that's not Andre the Giant, but they did have to get a shot, whether it's going to be in this sequence or not. They had to get a shot of Andre the Giant on a horse, just not riding away. So they rigged up this whole wire rig for Andre the Giant to be suspended over a horse, to make it look like he was on a horse, but the horse didn't actually have to hold all of Andre the Giant's weight. And Rob Reiner told a great story in an interview about being called over to the soundstage to watch them. Yeah, that ain't no Andre the Giant there on that horse there, right? And I'm sorry. He's got a wig on, but that's it. But, Rob Reiner tells a story about being called over to inspect the rig that is suspending Andre the Giant over a horse to see if it worked for his shot. And he walks into a soundstage and there's Andre the Giant, who's drunk as a skunk, swinging in midair. You know, there's a floating giant waving at me, says Rob Reiner. What has my life become? This is what my it's my job to inspect the floating drunken giant right now. That's my job today. And I've had that moment, and I think maybe all of us have had that moment, you know, being in a movie and you kind of go, you just sort of stop and look what you're doing at that moment and how bizarre it is and how most people probably would not have that experience as part of their work day.
Now, part of what we're going to get into in the aftermath, we're like 1 second away from the end of the movie, but we're going to get into our whole opinions of the thing like we always do. But this is the first movie in the history of the 30 North Down in Front commentaries that, due to, frankly, user error, there has been no subtitles on this movie. Usually there are subtitles.
That's and a good yet, point. Yeah. Like, we needed them.
No, we tried to do subtitles and we couldn't figure
it out.
We
couldn't get the button to push right.
Bride,
and it makes no difference at all for this movie.
And truly, this is the first movie in all of the movies you've ever heard on downinfront.net that have had no subtitles for the panelist audience.
We got about halfway through Monsters, Inc. before we realized it, too.
But, okay, Monsters, Inc. and The Princess Bride have something in common, which is that we made it some fraction of the way through the entire film watching experience before we realized we don't know what they're saying.
Or before we realized that we didn't have subtitles because we did know what they were saying.
And it's bizarre because many of the people that listen to Down in Front will be aspiring screenwriters or filmmakers of some...
Storytellers in any whatever capacity.
Storytellers in some capacity that will appreciate the nature of a movie, script, screenplay, story that has absolutely nothing to do with the words. This movie, and now we're into the credits, so great, we're coming up on the fade out of Down in Front. We're coming up on this moment where it's like, oh my god, we made it through an entire, we're coming up on 1 minute, 1 hour and 33 minutes of movie with no words at all. And of course, there's something to be said about the movie that we knew, but still, there's a story that took place that had nothing to do with the words. And for me personally, as a Down in Front experiencer, the one that surprised me the most was Watchmen, where we watched that 4 hour, 25,000 minute movie, where it's like, holy shit, I can't believe how much this movie carries without words. And even though we had the subtitles, in this movie we had literally none, and yet I feel like I've just watched The Princess Bride as, you know, obviously you guys all watched The Princess Bride listening.
You didn't even notice that the audio wasn't on?
I never noticed that the audio wasn't on.
You don't think the fact that watching it every day for a year and a half kind of
I was going to say, I mean,
necessary?
I think the point you're trying to make is the sense that we've talked about before with Jaws and other movies, in the sense that even with the sound off, you can still be visually drawn in and absorbed by this movie.
But this movie,
and then the Princess Bride qualifies.
Yeah, but you're also going to be missing half the good stuff because there are such great lines and character
aside bits and stuff like that. Yeah. Okay, Trey, go to the dick room. But for myself, as a person who is sure,
we have a dick room.
I'll grant you.
Did we have a dick room?
We have a whole dick room. It's an aside to the Down in Front warehouse where people. We listen to this movie in a beautiful gold-plated warehouse.
Why was I not informed?
When you're listening to Down in Front, just imagine us in this beautiful,
Adrian Biddle,
paradise of Down in Front listenery. But you know, sure, yeah. There's also a dick room off to the side. It's plated in beautiful.
Good to know.
Plated in dicks. That's what I'm saying. Why didn't I know about this? Anyway.
There goes the G rating for this show, by the way.
We haven't said fuck already.
Aside
five
from all
times.
This, we just watched, and now we're into the beautiful blue credits and scored by Mark
Knopfler.
It's
like a storybook story.
We had absolutely no subtitles, and this movie functions on every single conceivable level of cinematic endeavor. Like this
movie
except
for sound design.
Okay.
Which we just had to assume was good.
Characters, story, and obviously screenplay all come from various artisans within the realm of filmmaking, and this movie stands unto all of their absolute uninvolvement in the experience we just had as an experience of perfect filmmaking quality. Like, it's this perfect movie that stands beyond the realm of actual experience. It's just, you remind yourself of The Princess Bride and you think, man, if I was good, I would do something like that. Yeah, maybe.
I would like to die having made something like The Princess Bride.
Holy shit.
Man, you were masturbating a lot around this time in your life, weren't you? Just some good associations there.
Peter Montagna, who I'm guessing is a British, probably most likely a British British makeup artist, did their makeup because I'm not familiar with that name. But
there he is, Bob Anderson.
Good job. Bob Anderson, there's your man, Bob Anderson.
Teak Christie, red-haired panelist. I love this movie. Brian William Fendifter, how do you feel about The Princess Bride, William Goldman, and, frankly, Wallace Shawn's endeavors as a person?
And Shawn.
I don't think anybody...
Second unit Ireland, so they probably did fall down the...
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Somebody fell down a nice Irish hill.
I don't think anybody in the world apparently loves this movie as much as you do.
Yeah.
Fig. I don't know. What is there to say? It's a classic. It's so...
I'd like to, I mean, even Michael being, you know, as close to a naysayer as we have here, who just goes, I don't love it with all my heart. You know, that's the most you could do. It's like, I would like to hear from someone who doesn't like The Princess Bride. Use our forums if you'd like to. You know, and what is there not to like about The Princess Bride? At least not to like Michael, just to respect. This is, I get it, you know, and you don't have to love every movie. Maybe it's not totally your thing.
Brian, what is there not to love about The Princess Bride?
I could see how if you're not on board with the hokiness, because obviously it's doing it intentionally, but I could see somebody not being on board. And occasionally there are pieces of me, parts of me, and depending on the mood, sometimes I'm not on board with the hokiness and go, all right, I know you're doing it on purpose, but still, come on guys, really? So, I mean, I could see that. Otherwise, I don't know.
I don't think they go too far with it, though. There are some movies where you're on board with the hokiness, but then they keep going like, but then like,
I think this straddles that line perfectly.
Then the Billy Crystal character spends too much time on screen, and you're like, okay,
all right.
Like you're not as funny as you think you are. Okay,
a little bit much, kind of pushing it, bring it back. But
Brian,
then,
still to one sentence, The Princess Bride, go.
Damn,
your experience as a person with The Princess Bride. Are you in approval?
You just took your Katie Couric pills today or something. Yes. What is this with these attack questions all of a sudden?
I read papers. In what respect, Teak? In what respect?
I can so be vice president.
You aspire to be a famous and rich screenwriter. Does this movie make you feel depressed because you'll never be the Princess Bride guy? Or do you think you feel inspired?
It actually does both of me, which not many movies do. It's like it does inspire me to go... you can see the mechanics, you can see the pieces and how they work, and you almost feel like, yeah, I see the pieces and I can put those pieces together myself. And then the flip side of the coin is, wow, I will never put them together that well. But it's actually interesting in that it's one of those few examples that inspires both of those feelings in me, at least personally.
Now, Act Two, Han Solo doesn't end up with the princess. Dorkman, how do you feel about The Princess Bride?
Now you're just evolving into non sequitur.
Yeah, I'm confused.
Anyway, answer the question.
Exactly.
How do you feel?
I was all right until you brought that up. Yeah. And
how do you feel
like,
about the Goldman Doctrine?
Huh? Yeah, how could he leave that out? I mean, they've totally got to get
how do you
together
feel about the Goldman Doctrine. Yeah. That's a great question.
Actually, quite good. His books are very good. I would highly recommend. Yeah. I mean, we've recommended them
Done a commentary without recommending that you buy William Goldman's books.
Although what's interesting is
on a screenwriting level you're talking about.
Yeah, although what's interesting is he writes because he writes in an older style, you know, the way they wrote in like the 50s and stuff. You read his scripts now and a lot of it is quote unquote wrong. There's a lot of cut to and a lot of VC and a lot of
literally
directing the camera and stuff like that, and it's stuff you're told not to do anymore. You know, it comes through. And I think Goldman is a lot like, we mentioned kind of jokingly, but, a lot like Shakespeare and Mamet as well, which is if you read it on the page, it's like, I don't know about this, but when you see people perform it and they get it, you're like, oh, totally, you know?
No, now, I know that this is a weird hypothetical question, but...
Oh, that'll be a rare one today. Where on earth could this be coming from? Go ahead.
Do it.
Between myself and Brian and Trey, we all love this movie, and you didn't count among the ranks. Do you have any idea why?
I think it's just the kind of thing where, I mean, I saw it a bunch of times when I was a kid. I've never hated it, but it was just the kind of thing where I'm like, yeah, that's funny, and then I... kind of, you know, I went and watched Ghostbusters again or something.
And, it just didn't grab you.
Something. I mean, it didn't. I don't dislike it, and I'm never too surprised. There was a period where I was like, I'm tired of everyone always wanting to watch Princess Bride all the time, for God's sake. But I'm over that now. It's a good movie. I understand. I can appreciate it, and I understand why people like it. It's just there's something about it that it's like between this and another movie. It depends on what the other movie is, but I'm not always going to go for The Princess Bride.
Trey, Princess Bride.
You suck, Michael. You're an idiot and you're stupid and everything you like is bad. Because we're on the internet.
Yeah.
Hitler.
First. Yeah, you know who else liked The Princess Bride?
You know who liked The Princess Bride?
Hitler.
Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
That's like the third time we've Godwinned our show today.
Yeah, really.
But
we're, see, anyway. we're ironically Godwinging it.
Yeah.
What's the question?
We're at the end of the, we're looking at the DVD menu.
Oh, we're well
now.
Beyond.
It's a lovely
For
DVD
God's
menu.
Sake,
Brian was playing the game of some kind.
Find the Easter egg.
Yeah. How do you feel about The Princess Bride?
I'm sticking with, you know, nothing happened in the last 90 minutes that made me go, you know what? I'm going to rethink my status on The Princess Bride. I think it's an awesome film and I, like I said, I don't demand people enjoy it, but I think the movie's done its part to allow you to enjoy it, and you should let that happen. Open your heart and let The Princess Bride just flow into it and become part of you and become part of your life experience, and don't fight it and don't mock it and just let it happen. Let
You'll
it flow.
You want The Princess Bride every day.
Yes, let it flow. Because it's a miracle, The Princess Bride.
Mawage.
And it's what brings us together today.
And for my part, you know, actually, I've realized over
yes,
the course
T,
of this,
tell us how you feel.
Over the course of this commentary, I've realized I hate The Princess Bride. This movie, I get it now, why you all don't like it. This movie is, frankly, playing on every lowest common denominator available in the screenwriting realm.
There's gonna be a point where your odometer's gonna trip, and you know, maybe it was this time, maybe it'll be the next time, but you're just gonna go, I don't want to ever see The Princess Bride again. That was as many times in my life as I needed to
I
see
rolled
the
over
Princess
back
Bride.
To zero and yeah. I'm done.
I will
and
reach I'm the done. End of Pleasantville. Until then, The Princess Bride represents for me not only a very special part of my growing up process, which I'm trying to separate from myself for editorial liberty and just say,
but you can't.
On the merits of its own filmmaking prowess. Which Trey's right, I can't. But really on the can't. Merits of its own filmmaking prowess, this
you
movie...
You specifically. No.
Me. And I am, and as, no one as everyone knows, aside from the fact that I say everyone's name at the beginning, I am the least informed person on this fucking show. I love,
but you cover it well.
I love The Wild Wild West and Phantom Menace, and yet I have this weird moment where I can reconcile with the most elite of filmmaking goers and say... The Princess Bride, yeah, and have high fives and say things like, "A storm in the castle." I can have all those moments because not only do they have merit on a you know, genre wide and in fact beyond genre wide level, where it's like this represents a theme beyond even the scope of the movie, let alone the character. This movie is so we really go back to it all the time on the show. Not all the time. We watched Hook. But all the time on the show, the perfect movie, the concept of the perfect movie, where everything it sets up, it just plays out. And not so it plays out so that right when you reach the end of each individual arc, you stop that character and say, you're done with the movie. We're going to finish off the rest of the characters that haven't gotten there yet. Literally, every character plays out to a point of perfect harmony within the story and the universe of the story involved. This movie is maybe, and I don't want to.
You know, I really.
I don't want to.
I really wish this movie was a person, so you guys could just get drunk and bang. Because you need to sort this out. Yeah. I mean, this movie is never gonna love you back as much as you love it.
Yeah, and me,
I'm telling you that right now.
I mean, dude, she's cute, but goddamn. Wow.
This movie has eyes the color of the sea after a storm. Frankly, this movie, and this is my personal opinion.
I was going to rape her, but now I don't even want to.
Teak, repeat after me. I love it very much. The end.
We all have our own versions of what a perfect movie is, and to me, this is the one movie I compare all others to.
Okay.
Princess Bride is my favorite. Is one of my top three favorite movies of all time.
There's nothing wrong with that at all.
That's the end.
Alrighty.
Now, this has been Down in Front, and if you want to find more insane rapes of movies that we love, go to Down in Front. Because
we have slept with some ugly ones. There was some we got drunk and we really regret
Seriously,
doing.
Seriously, this one was a little stalkery. Gotta say.
Yeah.
We're digging through this movie's trash.
We
screwed
the shit.
So hard.
You can find that at downinfront.net, along with our Twitter page, twitter.com/downinfront. Find out every single week. And until next time, my name is T. Christy with my friends.
Brian Finisher.
Mike Scott.
Grace Dukes.
For downinfront.net, and you can find us every single week. Thank you very much for listening. Good night.
Good night.
So long. Have fun storming the castle.
It'd take a miracle.